Bob, good to see you today. How are you?
Hey, good afternoon, buddy. Thank you so much for carving out some time. I know you're extremely busy, but how's the Dino Lab treating you? Busy?
Well, it's behind me right now. We got the banner up. You don't see it, but I've been on it a lot and always is always busy. Sometimes it's good to you and sometimes it's mean to you, but that's what it's for.
I liked that your Instagram post, depending on people see this or I loved it. I had a picture of the bike on the dyno and said, always testing. And I was like,
Always testing.
amen to that. So
Yep. I'm
it's
sure
great to
in your
have you.
world's very similar data wise. So hey guys, welcome to the show. It's me and Coach Rob. I'm Derek Harris at HP Race Development, and we're talking about navigating amateur motocross. That's the theme of our podcast today. So last episode, I got too off the rails a little bit and wanted to get to more questions for Coach because I have a ton of them for you. And I also glossed over some things about your history in the last episode that I wanted to get into and just didn't. So the first one I had was at the very beginning of our podcast, you're like, yeah, I got invited to the Olympic Training Center. And I'm like, yeah, okay, cool. The reality is that probably pretty hard to accomplish. So what level of athlete would you have ranked yourself? I'm assuming in the endurance world with triathletes.
Yeah, you're exactly right. After the 1987 IBMXF World Champs, that's when my dad sent me off to college, as we talked about. And while I was in college, my roommate was training for Ironman New Zealand. And, racing BMX, I knew how to ride a bike and I knew how to run. I mean, I could play around the pool. So I literally started teaching myself how to swim and got serious about it. And then over the next couple of years here in Florida, ironically, right in central Florida, there's a little town called Claremont that many people are familiar with, but that's where pretty much the birthplace of triathlon came to fruition here in the Southeast. A lot of people are not aware of that. So if you're looking at the city of Claremont, if you look at where Ken Roczen lives, he lives right off of Lake Minnehaha. The next lake over, right underneath State Road 50, the little itty bitty bridge, there's Lake Mineola, and that's where all the triathlons take place. So we had a triathlon series here, started working my way through that, won that series. We had a running series. I started winning those. So now all of a sudden I'm an endurance athlete, and the sport of triathlon was trying to get into the sport of the Olympics. And so being a multi-sport athlete, we now had the opportunity to go to the Olympic Training Center. So I got invited to do some testing. And at that point in time, I mean, it was like from where the testing was at to actually having a team selection, you're probably looking at a good 4 to maybe even 10 years before that really ever came to fruition. But they were already starting to work on, hey, let's get a funnel of athletes. I got the opportunity to go out there. I tested for a week. And shortly thereafter, I was taking a buddy to the airport and we got hit by a guy that was stealing a van and got in a severe car accident on the interstate, blew my knee out. And unfortunately, back then, that was when, when they did a knee operation, they'd cut you from the top of the tib and go all the way up into your femur. So back in that day, in those days, if you had that kind of an injury, you pretty much were a lame duck. So my journey to being at the Olympic Training Center as an athlete was over. But what I was able to do, thank goodness, is being an athlete there, I had the opportunity to be underneath the tutelage of just some of the smartest people in the world. And after, no longer being an athlete, but had moved into the coaching realm, to this day, I'm still able to communicate and get a lot of clinical studies that come out of the Olympic Training Center. And that's what I really love, because when you look at the Olympic Training Center, they're not there to try to promote a brand. They could give two shits about what a label is on your shirt. They don't care if you're sponsored. The IOC and how they get their funding and how the sports do their funding and all that, it's its own entity. So they don't care what sponsored athlete you are in the endurance world. You could be Saucony, you could be ASICS, you could be Nike. They didn't really care. And I always loved that because, like I shared with you, I had gone out of my way to purge myself of Coca-Cola. And then I've got a German cycling coach going, you're an idiot. We use Coke to reactivate the digestive enzymes. I'm like, whoa, 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 say that again. You do what?
Yeah, it's not just something that tastes good. There's something scientific about that.
There's the key word. There's something scientific about why we do it. If you come full circle and if you go and you Google fructose, they'll pretty much tell you it's human poison. But yet at the Olympic Training Center, they had proven when your body stores sugar, it stores it in your liver, and your liver feeds your brain. You store sugar in your muscles, and that feeds movement. Well, they've proven that fructose is one of the most easily absorbed and convertible and usable energy sources for the brain, fructose, which is essentially poison. You see little things like that. If you just go and you look at it from a textbook standpoint, you go, nope, don't use it. Now, I'm not advocating that everybody should be out downing liters of Coca-Cola. don't take it out of context. It's kind of like me and Dungy and getting blackballed by the guy that advocates ice cream. Don't take it out of context.
Right.
When you're burning 6,000-7,000 calories a day, sometimes you have to go.
You got to do what you got to do.
You got to go different routes at least and do it as and healthy as you can.
You know, that's actually all my list of questions we'll get to later about dietary stuff.
Yep.
So what level of athlete would you say, like, you know, where were you, like, what would be, so you went from BMX, and that's a fast twitch sport, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And then you basically had to learn and convert into a, sorry, if you have background noise, the shop is rolling around. You had to convert into a endurance athlete. Was that a, like a big learning curve initially when you first got into it? And my next question on that was, there are slow twitch and fast twitch athletes in general. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's nature or nurture, meaning like, I think at a young age, you might be into fast twitch sports and mm-hmm. then you develop fast twitch. You know, that's kind of me as a kid, or you might be a, for whatever reason, as a young kid, you're into, you know, endurance stuff that would be rarer. But is that, so how was that process for you, and how long did it take before you really understood the long endurance type thing?
You know, first and foremost, props to yourself for being a mechanical engineer. What you just talked about, most people are not aware of. We are born with a certain type of muscle fiber types. You know, if for the listener, if you can run 100 meters fast, you're quick twitch. If you're somebody that can run 3 miles and enjoy it, you're more of a slow twitch. I was definitely born a slow twitch athlete, which made BMX extremely difficult for me. So my dad, being as smart as he was, if you look at gearing in the BMX world, now in today's day and age, they use different, completely different types of gearing combinations. So for example, if you look at the BMX bikes, when I was racing, the front sprocket had 42 to 43 teeth. And we always ran a 16 size freewheel in the back. So we'd say we were running a 43-16. Well, my dad was smart. I'm a slow twitch dude. So what did my dad do? He put me on a 45-16. So he would, what he would do was, I'd lose that snap out of the gate. I'd lose those first 2 to 3 pedals of acceleration, but my dad knew that I would pick it up on the backside. So we literally would play the game of chess. My line choice would be based on trying to open up every corner and try to get it on the top end speed. Now, not every track was conducive for that, because if, like, when we would do the Christmas Classic, which was literally an indoor track, it was a completely stark contrast then to something like the Murray World Cup, where the Murray World Cup, the first straightaway was probably 800 meters long. So you had plenty of time to get up to freight, and it was extremely wide track. We go indoors and you have maybe a 200 meter excel, you know, front straightaway, and it's very, very tight. I got screwed. You know, I was on the short end of the stick.
Interesting that you say this. I don't know BMX world. I didn't come through it or ever do it.
Yeah.
But in other realms of sport, like, let's just take running or I'm thinking ice skating for some reason, but like the speed skating. Yeah. In running, we have events that cater to each type of athlete.
Mm-hmm.
But that's probably not the case. I mean, there are different tracks, different events, so that caters to different BMX athletes, but we don't have a strict discipline of like, oh, this is a long track and then this is a short track. So to win lots of different races, you would have to be good at everything in BMX. So that's interesting, because in other sports like the Olympics, oh, we have the 100, the 200. Okay, that's a slow twitch guy. We have the 400, which is an intermediate. And then we have, 800,000, whatever. So
yeah.
That's interesting. Next on that.
Why that's so important, though, why you picked up on that, though, Derek, was I'm in a quick twitch sport with a slow twitch muscle fiber type. So my dad, I would warm up for 30 to 40 minutes to do less than a 1 minute race.
You knew that early on. He knew, you knew.
Yes. And then when I went to the Olympic Training Center, I got even more knowledgeable about what that means. So as I moved up through the BMX side of things, at the amateur level, I got to, ironically, 8th in the nation. I was racing against people like John Tomac, Todd Corbett, Eric Bartolish. You may know Big E from Yoshimura.
Yeah.
He was a big BMX guy. So it's interesting seeing McGrath and all these guys. We all raced together back in the day. Well, then you take that information and I move into an endurance-based sport. And then I go to the Olympic Training Center. I learned just a plethora of more information relevant to that. And that's where I'm just becoming a sponge, because now I'm realizing, okay, I don't know a lot, because I was only able to get access to what we had at the library. So now you bring in years of toolage, getting it in a Cliff Note version.
How did, so you make that transition. Was that like feeling right at home for you? Like, oh, wow, I really like this endurance side because it fits my body better.
It's interesting, because in the endurance world, particularly triathlon, we have four distances. We have sprint, which is a 1/4 mile swim, a 10 mile bike, a 3 mile run. That's considered sprint.
To me, that's like all endurance.
then we go to Olympic. That's what you see literally at the Olympics. We call it the Olympic distance. It's a 1 mile swim, 1.5K. It's a 40K bike, 24.9 miles, and a 10K run, 6.2. Then from there, we go to half Ironman, which is 1.2 mile swim, 56 mile bike, 13.1. And then we go to Ironman 2.4, 112, and 26.2. So it was great for me because as an athlete, right, in BMX, you just said it best, I had a box. Some tracks I could do well in, and that allowed me to be top 10 in the nation as a pro. I was able to get eighth in the world. That's great. When you get into triathlon, the world you're always is completely your playground because you can choose your races that are conducive. Like my forte, I always enjoyed cycling. So I always sought out the most difficult bike courses because I was a middle of the pack swimmer. I'd be in the top 1 or 2% on the bike, and then I'd be in the top 2 to 3% on the run. Well, collectively, you don't have to be the best at any. You just have right. to be good at all three.
Right.
So at that point, I was ranked in the nation in the top 10 quite often, but it's one of those things, and I don't know all the different sports on how they rake them. I grew up in a ball and stick sports, as we talked about in the last show together. My brother was, so I know how baseball does their rankings, but like, I don't know ice hockey and all the others. In the BMX world, you accumulate points constantly throughout the year. So literally the more you race, the better your points were. Now, the beautiful part about that was as we moved around to different races, they would weight the race based on number of people. They would give you an additional bonus points based on your time. And then, so now when you look at a national ranking, it's not just the person who had the most money that could race every weekend. It wasn't the guy that could cherry pick and just had no competition, but won everything on paper. That's something that I'm actually working on right now in the motocross industry for different reasons. And we'll talk about this at a different date because we are speaking about amateur racing and ranking. But think about how cool that was. As an athlete, I got rewarded for the more difficult the race, the more points you got. The deeper the field, the more points you got. And then they would say, okay, if we look at a benchmark for a fast 10K, if I get down in the low 32 range, that's okay. I mean, nowadays they're down in the 30 range. It's amazing how fast they're running off the bike. But it was cool because you're getting almost three different levels of points and accumulation. So now when we say Derek Harris is ranked number three in that 25 to 20
measurable metrics,
you're right. Absolutely.
Yeah. That's then, actually, and it's like, and golf is a little bit that way.
Absolutely. But if I'm going to line up, or if I'm looking at the start list, I'm looking at Derek Harris going, shit, this guy's a real badass runner. All right. So I'm going to have to change my strategy. And now literally for the next 2 to 3 months training for that race, knowing that you're going to be there, assuming you get there healthy. I'm like, okay, I'm going to have to change my strategy in the swim. I'm going to have to latch on, almost blow my wad, hanging on to their feet to get on the bike so I can do my thing to try to big enough gap because Derek's going to come on like a steamroller.
Right.
Can I put enough of a gap based on the characteristics of the course? Can I snap Derek's leg on a hard bike course to zap his run legs because he still has to get off and run?
Right.
Well, now think about the strategy. I've got points. I've got you. I've got the depth of the field, how many guys, the difficulty of the course. And if I do well, if I swim, bike, and run well on that difficult course, I get even more points.
Right.
So it's just, I like it because, and you and I have talked about this off the air, I try to live my life. I'm always looking to push the bar up. Like I'm 55 years old and I'm still trying to teach myself the guitar. I don't watch TV. I don't read the news. I don't read the newspaper. I know enough of what's going on because I just glance at certain websites, but I'm not going to waste a half hour watching a news broadcast when I can learn, try to push my gray matter to learn the guitar.
Right.
And that's what I liked about that type of training and point system. So
so the next on that was you switched over. So in motocross, how does it apply to an amateur? You would say we have these kids for these athletes. How would you identify that initially if you have like a fairly untrained athlete? So at number one, at what age is this important to know, for you to identify for a young kid? And because I think as a parent, they should know, hey, absolutely, your kid is more inclined towards this type of work. And I think I saw it was Chase and Levi, and it was a Peter Park, this year, I believe it was. But he had made a little comment like Kenny is a fast switch guy. And so he's just built that way. And then you have Chase, who's more of the long duration type guy. He was saying that, and I don't know how accurate this is, I'm asking you, you can't do the same work between the two ultimately at that level because Kenny wouldn't handle the workload that Chase does on the long endurance side. And then on the flip side, Chase is just not cut out to do the type of explosive work that Kenny's able to do. So I guess they at that level are trying, you know, at the pro level, you're trying to identify that. At an amateur level, how important is that? What does it affect for your workouts? Or is it something that when they're young enough, you can develop each skill set through training?
It's a fantastic question, because what it boils down to is expectations. If your athlete is a slow twitch, what we call a diesel engine, and they have to do a 5 or 6 lap race that's only maybe 8 minutes in duration, this is why the parents get so mad, because they're like, why does Johnny come on so strong the second half of the race? Why is Susie a slug at the beginning of the race? Well, you could throw in, maybe they're not mentally focused, they're not really excited. It's all about expectations. So when you talk about how soon does it really matter to be able to identify what type of athlete you have, it's imperative. Because if the athlete doesn't realize that he or she is not a sprinter, then they have to understand you've got to be warmed up enough to kind of trick the body into thinking it's already been out there for 10 minutes. Then when the gate drops, you're like, oh, minute 11, I'm coming on strong. Well, now it's the first lap.
Right. You had mentioned last time some science behind warming up. Can you read? I actually think I heard it also on the Gypsy Tales podcast. Can you go into that really quickly about some of the neuromuscular and, like, I think it was even like when you can absorb nutrients, when you can't, and warming the body up. So especially if you're a long twitch athlete, warm up becomes hypercritical, like you said, so that your body thinks you're at minute 11, not minute one.
Yep.
But number two, what is the science behind that? And why is a warm up probably the most overlooked thing I've ever seen in amateurs? Number one.
Yeah.
And number two, why is it so important? And what is some of the science behind the warm up? Because a lot of people are like, oh, I'm going to get tired.
You hit the nail on the head. Most people don't warm up because they're tired. I always just say get in shape. I mean, that's just an easy fix. If you're worried about doing a 10 or 20 minute warm up, you've got bigger problems.
And it shouldn't be just like it should actually be it's what I'm asking. How strenuous should your warm-up be and all that kind of stuff?
Well, and that's where people take it out of context. If you don't know what your heart rate zones are, it's easy to overdo the warm-up, which then leaves you tired, of course. But when you look at the idea of, especially with me being in Florida, right? We only have 2 seasons in Florida. That's hot and it's hotter. That's all we have. And it's always 100% humidity during the winter. I think we get our humidity percentages might get down into the 70s.
Right.
And you have to realize that when you're in a humid environment, when your skin tries to wick away sweat, water will not evaporate in a moist environment. It's called a water blanket. So there's a distinct difference between being metabolically warmed up and being hot. And this
Correct.
Is where
it's not
something
just a body temperature or a feel thing. Right.
Well, like when people are at Loretta's and they're dripping in sweat and they're sitting underneath an umbrella and they're like, the idea of warming up seems completely foolish.
But metabolically, you haven't turned on the body. So when you do a warm up, you are, and let me lead you here a little bit, maybe turning on certain receptors or neuro thing or getting your body to be prepared.
You hit the nail on the head. You're hitting not only the muscular warming up. Most people can visualize warming up a motor. Well, you've got to warm the muscle tissue up, but you're really, if you think about in the human body, the only role of hormones is to communicate. So when you start creating some muscle movement, creates friction, friction creates heat, heat creates vasodilation, nutrient-rich blood flow comes in. But when that friction starts to create, hormones start communicating. They're like, hey, whoa, what's going on here? The body wants to never die of a heat stroke nor freeze to death. Muscles start creating heat, hormones get released. And this is where we activate an enzyme known as the glycogen synthase enzyme, and you get what's called the lactic acid shuffle moving. So again, don't worry about the terminology. Just imagine that there's a lot of communication going on in the blood. The last thing you want to do is be sitting on the starting gate and go from a heart rate of 85 to 185.
I've seen weightlifters or something, and it just blew my mind because I didn't know this, but really strong powerlifters will actually do fairly heavy warmups, and they start really light and then work their way heavier and heavier into a max effort lift, like when they're trying to get the best max.
Yes.
To me, I'm like, oh, it's just going to make you, you know, a lot more tired. But the reality is, I think that, like, as you're saying, not only is there the warm up that's critical, but then number two, all of a sudden the body is getting those neuroreceptors going, getting all everything lined up to go make that great effort.
That's exactly right. And we could do an entire 2-hour conversation on just the neuromuscular side of what you're mentioning. I want the listeners to think about this. It's the easiest illustration. And if you've heard me say it before, I apologize. It's redundant. When I'm 55 years old, how many times have I gone in the refrigerator and reached in for a gallon of milk that weighs 8 pounds when full, only to lift it when it's 3/4 empty? And what do you end up doing? The neuromuscular message is to lift that amount of weight. And so what do? It's empty. So the neuromuscular message sends it up, which is what explains why your lifters do what they do. You're just gradually saying, because it's pretty, I know it kind of sounds like psychobabble. If you're in the gym and you're lifting 20 pounds and then you lift 25 pounds, let's say you're doing bicep curl, you're lifting 20 pounds, you go to 25, you go to 30, what's your brain thinking's next? 35.
Right.
So that's where you get into the neuromuscular. And I know people, because you can't see a neuromuscular firing, they're like, oh, that's hogwash. No, no, no. Why is your second set in the gym always easier than the first? Because the neuromuscular, it literally sends a message to say, lift 30 pounds. Okay.
Well,
I've been lifting 5 pound increments. The brain goes 35 plus, I'm getting ready to lift 40. Right. So it fires that extra bit. That's what we call the overload principle, tied in with the familiarity principle.
So the warm-up cannot be overlooked. If you're an amateur racer, this is something you have to sort out.
That's where heart rate monitors come in.
Right. One challenge would be if you have a, like most amateur racing at local tracks, you might just have a, you know, four or six motos you're doing and it's just fun. So it's challenging to warm up between each, you know, between each moto, but essentially how long does a warm-up last? Let's say you did a good thorough warm-up. You go out, you do your motos, and you have 30 minutes to an hour between them. Is there a lot needed between them, or can you just kind of carry over from what you were doing because you've already woke up the body?
We could spend another 2 hours answering that one question, but for the sake of time, this is where heart rate monitors become so important. If you know that your race zone is 160 to 160, or let's say 160 to 165, and your resting heart rate is 60, not trying to insult anyone's math, you can see there's a 100-point difference. So when you're looking at the idea of you went out and you raced and you came in, you got cooled off, your heart rate's down nice and low. And even though it's only been 20 minutes, look at your heart rate. If you're racing at 160 and your heart rate's sitting at 60, even though it's hot, even though you may still even be sweating from your last moto, you're not metabolically warmed up again.
Okay. So this is something that maybe a lot of people are missing and it could be huge for them. And then, like you said, if they're getting too tired, hey, you need to get in shape.
Well, that's the hard part because people say, oh, that's easy. That's your wheelhouse. You're telling everybody to get in shape. No, I'm not. It's not my wheelhouse. The law of physics and the law of physiology and the law of nutrition has to be understood and applied. It's no different in your world.
Right. You know, it's funny you say warming up, like how long it takes. It's not just immediate. And so, for example, to give you a great example of this that I just saw the other day, and I actually had a little debate somewhere on one of the socials, was some guy was like, I think I made a thing about properly warming up your bike, or made a comment that about warming up your bike, and all the pro teams do it. They warm up the bike for a very long period of time by most people's standards at the track.
Yeah.
You know, nowadays the bikes are so well engineered. You fire them up, you blip the throttle a few times. It's been 1 minute. You hit the rev limiter as a kid 50 times over and you go ride. But the reality is only the water temperature's up, not all the parts was inside your motor. Even if the oil temp was up, that doesn't mean that the rod and that the crank and that all the parts and pieces are at full operating temp that they will be at when you come off the track. Mm-hmm. And so luckily through good engineering, the parts just work. We've got the tolerances right and all that stuff. But back in the day, they didn't. You really had to warm up your bike. And it's like nowadays, who warms up their car? Like, you're in Florida, it's not so bad, but a lot of people I see in the winter here just fired up and, you know, straight out the driveway.
Yeah.
That's good engineering. You're very fortunate that it works, but in your day coming up, you could not do that to your vehicle. It just would be hard on it. You had less life. Everybody knew that.
Yep.
So the same with parts. Like, I saw a video where a guy had a magnetic heater, I forget which, induction heater. And he's like, you know, it can make parts cherry red, right? So you can put it in there if you want to make something really hot or bust a nut off or whatever. But he was holding it by his hand on a drill bit, stuck it into where it was glowing red on the bottom and could still hold the top. And what does that tell you? That particular material does not have a high thermal conductivity rate.
Okay.
So that it's so hot here, and he was able to hold it for a minute before he's like, hey, it's starting to get warm. I'll set it aside. But go do that with copper or go do that with aluminum and your hand will be cooked instantly. So the parts in your engine are all dissimilar materials. There's steel, there's aluminum, there's bearings that have poor contact, there's oil, there's all these different materials, but they all wish to be at equilibrium at one temperature. And it takes a long time for that heat to conduct its way through equally through all the parts. So a warm up on a motorcycle engine is very important. It's important that you do it right. And you will get better performance and better life out of your bike, even if you're running it more hours, but you're just letting it run at an idle, essentially very low RPM, you're going to get better life. And I think that in your case of the body, you're probably going to get better performance at the track with a proper warm up. So that's a great,
that's
overlooked.
100%. And it goes back to what you were just saying. Muscles warming up is kind of like you're saying, people, they can familiarize themselves with that and they go, okay, I touch my pipe, it's warm. I touch the casings, it's warm. But that doesn't mean the bearings and the rod and everything on the internals are. Goes back to what we said earlier. You've got to get the enzymes activated, hormones start communicating, then you've got the lactic acid shuffle starts to engage. So as the presence of lactic acid, which is just a byproduct of converting stored sugar, glycogen, into energy, you remember back in biology 101, Krebs cycle, right? The same way that you know combustion, and we understand that's coming out the back of the pipe. Well, as your body converts stored glycogen into energy, it releases a hydrogen ion. It's acidic by nature, and we get lactic acid from that in layman's terms. But from a 10,000 foot view, the accumulation of lactic acid isn't going to be dissipated unless everything's at an equilibrium temperature. Now, I'm using those interchangeably on purpose. As the muscle temperature goes up, you've got to imagine that the hormone levels are elevating, the communication is elevating, the dilation is happening. Now, as you roll your throttle on and you put your hand back behind the pipe, you can feel the increased combustion coming out. Well, as you start to elevate your heart rate, you produce more lactic acid. So you want the system to be ready to dissipate the byproduct it's about to create. Now, here's something that a lot of people don't realize. When you bring the heart rate up, I want you to think about this, Derek, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot. We obviously don't rehearse our conversations. 9 out of 10 people, if I were to ask them, what is it that's always advocated on the marketing side of fruits and vegetables? They're high in antioxidants.
Okay.
So when your heart rate is elevated and you're converting stored glycogen into sugar, you have a metabolic byproduct, just like we do combustion and waste in a motor. You produced free radicals. Now, free radicals are what make you have the dark circles under your eyes, the wrinkles on your face, dry hair, dry skin. And you can see kids in their 20s and 30s, that especially triathletes that are in the sun a lot, they look like leatherback turtles. That's because of the excessive amount of free radical production in the body. This is why high intensity training is so detrimental to your health.
Okay.
Free radical production, hence focus on the word free radical.
Right.
If you get into scientific terms, is a byproduct of oxidative stress.
Right.
Now you understand where antioxidants come from, which is a byproduct of free radical production associated with high heart rate, which is why we have high levels of adrenal fatigue in our sport.
Oh, okay. So it's funny. Now, I actually had this prep for our chat here today, and I wanted to bring this up to people that they probably hadn't thought about. So your engine, your body is an engine of variety, and it's just a different type of engine than a motorcycle engine. But they both take a form of chemical input and then convert it into energy. And that energy is actually, a motorcycle engine is a heat engine. Most people don't know this. And so essentially you take chemical energy, you add oxygen, you add a little bit of heat and a spark, which is heat, and then it produces a large amount of heat. And that heat is what pushes down on the piston. It's an expansion cycle. And so it moves your piston down because it expands the gases, which is a basic chemistry formula, you know, P1 V1 equals P2 V2. And there's another formula that brings into account temperature. So as temperature rises, volume increases. So we get to push down on the piston. So here's a great little one for your guys. And I love that you're talking about the body and the oxidative stress and whatnot, because what would you, I mean, you may not know off the top of your head. I don't know off the top of my head. I had to look it up, but what is the chemical structure of sugar?
Oh, that's a good one.
So it's basically, and this is so funny about when we talk about hydrocarbons and, you know, dead dinosaurs and whatever, right?
Yep.
So there's several different types of sugar, but when asked for a generic one, right? Like sucrose or whatever, is C12H22O11. And there's variants of that, right?
O11 is the one I couldn't figure. Okay.
Right. Yep. So it's a C12. What is one of the most popular gasoline sold on the planet from BP?
C12,
right? Yeah. So what do you think the structure is of gasoline? So gasoline does not have the oxygen inherent in it the way that sugar does. Believe it or not, when you want to make model rocket engines, you can use sugar and make your own homemade model rocket engines, because it has its own oxygen, doesn't require oxygen to burn, and it has a carbon and a hydrogen. So what we do is we add oxygen to that process as well, and a little bit of heat, combustion, and then sugar turns into CO2, which is what our body expels, water, which our body expels, as well as some byproducts that, you know, combustion byproducts that are not really intended, but they happen. Well, gasoline is essentially the same. So generic gasoline, which is often referred to as octane, is C8H18. So very comparable in molecular structures, and there's different molecular structures out there for different gasolines and different, you know, benzenes and toluenes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But the processes are the same. Your body takes in hydrocarbons and it converts it into CO2 heat, which is energy. And we actually, so believe it or not, the human body is far more efficient at converting energy. Mm-hmm. So we take chemical energy and make it into an energy process, and we lose a lot less of it as in heat, whereas a combustion engine is 100% heat. We convert like 30-40% of it in power, and the rest of it is just wasted. Yes. The body is far more efficient, but it does so much slower at a much lower rate. Like 1 horsepower for a human would be like unbelievable, right? And we can have a 1 horsepower engine be really tiny. So anyway, I just find that so unique and so interesting that the chemistry is very similar, but you're talking about what happens in that body and in that cell, and we're just taking those molecules and producing energy with them.
Well, that's why it goes back to, when I say we as an industry, we as a sport, we as a people, we can't argue with physiology and we can't argue with the principles of nutrition no more than you can argue with the law of gravity, as we teased about in our last show. And the more that people stop plugging their ears and going, oh, it's so complex, it's really not. Again, we're not going into the nitty gritty, C11, 212, that just kind of go with this on the conceptual side of it. But when you are looking at the science behind it and you draw the parallels, it is astounding. You just mentioned something, and I always use this analogy. When we look at the human cell, and you look at the fact that the human cell, when it's healthy and it's hydrated, right, it's got a nice big surface area. Well, as a cell becomes less and less hydrated, the surface area of the cell shrinks, carries less oxygen. Just think about that at a 10,000 foot view. One of the things that we've been working on tremendously is we have the ability, we have 4 formulations of our own sports drink that we created ourselves because it's not on the market. It's literally, Derek, based on the intensity and the duration. The carbohydrate molecule is actually adjusted based on how quickly you need to convert it because of your high heart rate, how long you're going to burn it. That dictates the formulation that we use. And then we adjust the electrolyte profile according to your sweat rate. Pretty straightforward.
That's very similar to an engine, I would think, on tailored gasolines that have unique molecular structures.
Exactly.
For applications.
Where the parents are going to have an aha moment. That's my job. That's why we are the science of performance. I created sports drinks because I noticed that there wasn't sports drinks that were designed specific to the intensity and the duration. See a need, fill a need. We talked about this on the show too. Now you take it a step further. If an athlete, regardless of age, becomes more than 2% dehydrated.
I was going to ask you this. Yeah.
Yep. 2% dehydrated, you could lose 10% of your endurance. As a general rule of thumb, that's the mathematical equation that the physiological world uses in layman's terms. Now you're 4% dehydrated. You've lost 20%. Of your endurance. So over here, you've got a tremendous amount of endurance. People don't understand the importance of hydration, and walking around and drinking water dilutes the electrolytes in your blood. So please don't be walking around drinking a gallon of water. There's a formula for sweat rate, which we can get into if you're interested. But how many parents have you seen lose their marbles because they're like, I don't get it. My little Johnny, my little Susie, they work their ass off. They work so hard. And then we go out to the race weekend and they start with a bang and end with a fizzle. Well, is it a dehydration issue? Is it an electrolyte issue? Is it a, we can just it like the bike's be, not running.
You have
running,
to go down the
you have
the
to go down. It.
Right. But and actually for Loretta's and specifically, yes. This is really important that we've learned. It's like on the engine tuning side, but on the body, it's the same. A lot of people don't deal with the humidity and heat that exists at Loretta's. Now out of Florida, out of Texas, that's not a problem. And some of the like East Coast states, I think North Carolina, Virginia, South Carolina, they're hot and humid too during the summer.
Yes.
But not like we are year round where you're just adapted to it. So here you will learn very quickly. Like if you just don't do basic electrolytes when you hydrate, whatever that is, you're screwed. Like,
yes,
you're just done for. So at the end of the day, you go to Loretta's, you trained, your kid's in shape, but he's been a dry, not a super hot, not a environment where he's losing the sweat rates that he is at Loretta's, let alone walking around out there. And all of a sudden you get not just dehydrated on water, like you said, but the electrolytes too. And then of course they're just pounding water if they're trying to keep up with it. And hey, you're not, I've actually heard this. Is this true? You can dehydrate yourself by drinking too much water, and dehydrate in the sense that you just blow out all your electrolytes by just drinking too much pure water.
You're not dehydrating yourself, but you put yourself into a dangerous situation known as hyponatremic. So if you look at the blood volume and you look at the profile of your blood, you should have all of your electrolytes at what we call a saturation level. When you take in excessive amounts of water, what happens is you dilute, as you just alluded to, you dilute those electrolytes. Well, electrolytes are necessary for muscle contraction and water absorption. It has a dual role. So you notice when you drink a sports drink, you find yourself urinating more. That's how it validates that it's working. if you find yourself, and this is a very, very serious, and I hope everybody listening will stop doing what you're doing and listen to this, because this is literally a difference between life and death. When you find yourself not able to quench thirst and you just keep pounding straight water, notice the word water, you're just pounding water. What happens is you'll start to actually have a distended belly because you're no longer able to absorb the water and you can't urinate it out because there's no electrolytes. You'll have the same characteristics as if you're inebriated, slurred speech, loss of balance, blurry vision. This is what, unfortunately, what took out Josh Lichtel.
When he had the heat stroke at Redbud, yeah.
Yes, because what happens is you've got Google that says, hey, if it's going to be hot and humid, make sure you drink a lot. The formula, I hope every parent will write this down. The formula for your son or daughter to stay properly hydrated, and for every human being alive, the formula is exactly the same. Take your body weight in pounds, divide it by 2, and that's how many ounces you need to take in over a 10-hour period. So, for example, if I weigh 200 pounds, I need 100 ounces. That's 10 ounces an hour.
Right.
Well, a gallon's 128 ounces.
Right.
So the problem that you run into, and Michaela and I, we were actually, we were in California doing a performance camp. And we went to a local gym because we were out there for 3 weeks. We went to a performance gym, and all over the gym, they had these post-it notes that says, drink a gallon of water a day, drink a gallon of water a day, drink a gallon of water a day. Now take that formula and reverse it.
No, for a kid, there just makes no sense, like you said.
Well, it's deadly. It's right. Deadly because if you take the formula that we just gave you and you do the math the other direction, the only person that should drink 128 ounces is someone who weighs 256 pounds.
Right.
But that's the danger, is you'll have somebody that's so-called, you know, an expert, right, especially with social media. Hey, drink a gallon a day.
And it comes from good intentions. Like they say that mm-hmm. pathway to hell is like, hey, people are chronically dehydrated. So why don't we challenge them to, right?
Well, but this is day, why
it's not good.
This is why in that radio contest in Atlanta, they ended up having a water drinking contest. They put, I think, 3 or 4 women in the hospital. One did die.
Wow.
And that condition is known as hyponatremia. Okay. And that's what unfortunately happened to Josh Lichtel.
So it's critical not to just drink overhydrate water-wise, but it's going to have to be loaded with the right amount, like you said, the sweat rate and their particular kind of consumption rate.
Well, there's two sides of the hydration envelope, or two sides of the coin. What do you need to stay alive? We refer to that as basal metabolic needs. Stick to that formula. Body weight in pounds, divided by 2, spread it out over 10 to 12 hours. Because you don't want to,
you can't do it 24/7, right?
Yeah. Well, no, the problem is people get busy or they get behind and then they try to play catch up and then you're up all night urinating. So now you have piss poor sleep, right. No pun intended, because you're getting up so much.
That's probably where the expression comes from.
Yeah. And then the other side of the equation is sweat. So when someone says, are you properly hydrated? You've got to look at what you consume on a daily basis, plus what you're losing in sweat rate. Anybody that's listening to this show, if you go to the description box below here on YouTube, you'll see a link to Coach Rob resources. Our sweat rate calculator is there. Please use it. Live and die by it. Use it, use it, use it, use it. One of the things that we're doing right now is, and you guys, by the time this podcast drops, you're going to already have seen that I've started to drop some information. Underneath our CRS performance umbrella, we have an entire process and a system where we can evaluate your sweat rate in a non-invasive way. We can evaluate your sweat rate on what you lose quantity-wise, as well as what you're losing on the profile, how much sodium, potassium, and calcium, all of them. And then I can adjust my energy fuel to you as an individual around our 4 formulations. So not only is our energy fuel based on intensity and duration, we now have a simple device and we're going to make it available to the public. And then our team will evaluate that data and we'll convey it to our manufacturer. So when Derek orders a new bag of energy fuel, let's say he does energy fuel boost, once I have that sweat rate information, which our team will analyze, all you got to do is wear it, analyze it, allow us access to the data. We will contact our manufacturer. And every time Derek orders, he now has his own custom electrolyte profile specific to what he loses in the form of sweat and how much.
Okay. So you're making a product that uniquely hydrates. So we're getting very specific here, but if you decided to go that route.
I only bring it
you
up
can because have like electrolyte said, that suits you.
Well, I don't want to get so much into the weeds about electrolytes. It's you can't absorb water effectively without electrolytes. So you better make sure that you have the right amount and what your body needs specifically.
Correct.
And when we're looking at the sweat profile,
can we be over electrolyted? Like in the sense, so no. What happens if you're a little bit too much on the salt side, a little bit,
you'll urinate it out. You'll just urinate it out.
We would rather err on that side. Correct.
Yep. What's the worst thing that happens?
But like they say, you know, people like the fad diets, oh, salt's the enemy. I know. I mean, let's be honest. I'm not an expert on this, but when you're an athlete, you need salt for whatever type.
Yeah.
Or unless you will be in trouble.
Salt is a very sensitive subject because if you have a genetic disposition to hypertension, yes, you need to be careful of your salt intake, but I'd say 9 out of 10 people, they don't get enough salt as it is. When you look at cramping comes from one of three or a combination of three things: insufficient amount of water, insufficient amount of electrolytes, or putting too much load on the muscle tissue. That's it. That's the only reason why a muscle will cramp. What our job is as a company is to educate the parents and the riders. How much do you sweat? How much do you, with that information, I can help you put together a replenishment strategy. When you look at, like, for example, we advocate snacking on fruits and vegetables. Well, fruits and vegetables are high in electrolytes, water, fiber, everything that the body needs to be healthy. If you look at the idea that people want to convolute nutrition and they'll say, hey, take out all fruits in your diet because it has sugar in it. Stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life.
Right.
If you look at the macronutrients, carbs, protein, and fat, think about those as a log when you and I go camping and you and I walk up with a match and we try to get a 12-inch log to light up. Well, fruits and vegetables are the catalyst, vitamins and minerals are the catalyst of energy. They're the kindling that makes the log burn. So when someone says strip a food group out, punch them straight in the face.
Right. We could touch on diet too. And I was going to say, how, you know, there's all sorts of diets out there. There's fad diets, not diets. I mean, and then the information is hard to find. Like I've been researching a lot in this avenue with some stuff I've been trying to sort through, but I watched on the Gypsy Tales podcast, you said, hey, in your opinion, ultimately a relatively well-balanced diet, which would be fruits, a protein, I'm assuming a meat of some variety or similar, and some veggies. If you put all that on one plate, you are essentially going to be pretty much sufficient for probably all the way through amateurs, right?
All the way through life, walk in the grocery store, shop.
Like, do you feel like tailoring your diet? Is there like testing that can be done at the elite level that helps certain people out? Because obviously there's food allergies and stuff. I'm not even talking on that, but maybe certain bodies respond better to certain food groups or certain types of things.
Absolutely. That's what we call the textbook test. And the audience may have heard me use this on other podcasts, but I have a client who eats red apples and his face swells up. If you look at it in a textbook or you go to Google, they'll say red apples is relatively healthy, right? It's got fiber, it's got vitamins, it's got water. Unfortunately for him, it doesn't work. He's also the same individual that can eat yogurt but cannot drink milk. But unfortunately somebody said, oh, you're lactose intolerant. No, there's lactose, milk, sugar in both. But the yogurt he can eat, the milk he reacts to. So that's why I love what you said. There's a difference between a sensitivity and an absolute not able to, like for somebody who has legitimate celiac disease, you should probably not touch gluten.
Right. But some people just have a sensitivity to it.
Well, but you'll have some parents that'll watch the show and they'll have some so-called expert trainer who doesn't let his athletes eat gluten and they think that's the gospel.
Right. Well, and I researched down that road a little bit and it was like the percentage of people that have actual celiacs is very low. So like all this whole gluten-free movement or may not have any rooted evidence.
Follow the money. Right. I mean, I laugh at Michaela. I laughed at Michaela when we walked through the grocery store. If you remember when cholesterol was the enemy, right?
Right.
If you walk down the if you walk down the cereal aisle in the grocery store, I remember seeing Cheerios said cholesterol free. The only thing that has cholesterol in it is animal products. For the most part.
Right.
But when was the last time you saw an animal product in a box of Cheerios?
No. Yeah.
but that was the big marketing move.
Because that was the buzzword at the time.
It was cholesterol. Right. So if you walk in the grocery store.
How deep? So I had a lot of questions on if you're a parent, here's a kind of, it's intertwined to diet and a couple other things your kid's on 50s or 60s. He's young.
Mm-hmm.
How stringent or strict are we? Or are we just trying to keep him off of just junk food per se? Like, hey, let's try to have some fruits. Let's try to have some vegetables. Let's try to have some real meats. But at the end of the day, if I can keep them off of just eating, you know, packaged foods and snacks and whatever, like that's a success. And at that age, for the most part, I don't know, but isn't it true that if the kid's very active, actually riding moto isn't clearly overweight, he could pretty much eat what they want to eat as they need to, right?
Yeah. I always say it this way. Let's not even look at it from an athletic performance standpoint. Let's just talk about general health. It is not as complicated as the media likes to make it out to. A fruit, a vegetable, and a lean protein. If you want to put it in different terms, walk in your grocery store, shop the perimeter. And then your ultimate goal is to avoid anything that's in a box, a bag, a can, or a wrapper. Now, that's very idealistic. If you go into my kitchen right now, I've got boxes of, ironically, remember the company Nature's Bakery that sponsored TLD yeah. team? They make the best Fig Newton bars I've ever been able to find. Now, the reason why I bought them initially, because I believe in supporting those that support the sport. I'd never right. seen the name before. They weren't in Florida. They started to come into Florida. I remember from TLD. I bought them. They're the best tasting. There's multiple flavors. So we buy 5 boxes a week because they have blueberry right. and raspberry and everything. So walk in the store and try to avoid anything that comes out of a wrapper or a can for the lion's share of your diet.
Right.
Now, in all transparency, and I don't think AC will have a problem with it, when I was working with AC on 85s, he had a gag reflex. So like if you have an athlete, like the texture of a particular fruit or vegetable makes them gag and regurgitate immediately, don't try to stuff right. it down their throat. It down. Yeah, right. you're just going to wear it, right? So we came up with a product where it's literally ground vegetables. Like we have a complete, right. we have a product called Complete Purples, which is all your high antioxidant, like blueberries, blackberries.
Okay.
We have an orange, a green, and they're literally called power greens, or they're called, you know, they're called complete greens, purples, yellows, or oranges. The point is this, it's easy for us to sit here and say, don't eat, don't eat, don't eat, don't eat. All I'm saying is for the basis of foundation, try to focus on a fruit, a vegetable, and a lean protein source, whatever that is. And preferably and if you start that
early,
yes, it's a habit.
Establishing habits later down the road for that athlete exactly. and person in life. So what about like, what point do you think, so let's say we do it, we're not super stringent as a young athlete.
Yes.
But at what age and what, you know, what level of racing do you think that, hey, we really need to get serious about watching our diet? And I don't know how serious this is for you, but like, do we weigh our food? Do we, how much our intake, you know, really start to track it? At what age, at what level do you think that becomes something that's worth pursuing?
Never,
never,
never. Okay. Never. It's asinine because this is the reason why, especially with the advancements that Garmin has made. When I was at the Olympic Training Center, they had a very simple formula. Take your body weight in pounds, add a zero. That's how many calories you need on a daily basis. I would challenge anybody who's listening to this, that's running a Garmin, go look at your body weight, look at what your daily calorie burn rate is. And I guarantee it's probably within 100 calories. I've tested it with thousands upon thousands of athletes, which I give credit to the Olympic Training Center because these watches have really.
And that's your non-active rate, or
that's your basal metabolic okay. rate. That's how many right. calories you need to sustain life. What they would tell us is when we're at the Olympic Training Center and they did it on hours, they would start with that baseline, and then for every hour they would add anywhere between 500 and 600 calories. Now that was for me based on that current body weight. So please, right. if you've got a 100-pound athlete,
right.
you don't need to be adding 500. This is where the Garmin.
It's tracking.
Well, it'll take into consideration the age, the body weight, everything associated with that individual. So now the calorie rate is actually calculated, which helps you put together, we refer to it as reverse engineer. I'm not going to sit here and say, eat this amount of calories. Let the watch tell us how much you're burning. And then right. let's build a meal plan off of that. From real solid foods as well right. as liquid calories. Because when you bring the heart rate up, the food complexity has to come down.
Okay.
There's going to be a lot of-
The next question on young kids that I had was, let's say the diet. So it's not as, it's do eat relatively healthy from just a super basic standpoint. And I know people yeah. deep dive, oh, I'm into carnivore, I'm into vegan, whatever. But like from-
That's fine. That's right, fine.
You can, I heard a guy, a doctor say this, he's a proponent of one particular diet, but he said, look, if you're thriving on your existing diet and those are your convictions and belief and you feel great and you look great and there's no headaches, hey, go for it. But mm-hmm. But his thing was, you're making a choice. If you're choosing to be vegan, you're choosing to be vegan. That's a mental choice you've made, and you're really looking after what you eat. And the same applies to other types of diets. So that's great. Mm-hmm. I was going to say that on, how much focus do you think kids should have at 65s, 50s, 85s, 125s on just moto? And then how much should they have on other sports? Like we talked about before, I think kids should be multi-sport athletes, especially young, to get this coordination, which you had said was, what term was that? When you have this awareness.
Proprioceptive balance.
Right. Yep. So what would you say to a parent who's, you know, getting into the sport? I have my views, but what's your view on how should they jump all in on 50s and 65s and only do moto and full training facility and year round, or should they maybe have a different type of approach?
No, we haven't spoken about this off the record, and this is the first time we've spoken about it together. I have just seen over the last 39 years, the most successful athletes are the ones that are multifaceted. Now, you're always going to be able to pull me out like an Adam C. He did nothing but moto. And as I used to tease him, if you go back and you watch the videos, and I would encourage people to do this for fun entertainment, go back and find the videos of AC training with Villopoto at Grant Langston's old place, now known as Moto Sandbox. He's got an RC car and he tries to run to go get the RC car. And he looks like a drunk giraffe. He's the most lopiest thing ever. And AC's been public on a lot of podcasts that thank goodness he's good at moto, because he's not good,
not good at anything else. Right.
Yeah. Now that, again, I had the privilege of working with AC, but I think that's more the exception than the rule. Most everybody else that I've seen that have gone the distance, they're good at other things. Like Jordan Bailey I worked with, that guy can shred on a golf course. That guy is good with the basketball. He's a very talented athlete all the way around.
See, that's my experience. Historically, great moto athletes were good athletes in general. Capable, could run, could jump, could throw baseball, could catch, could play, you know, all of the sports. And then I think what I'm seeing now, and this is why I asked you this question, is I am seeing a departure from that. I see a more and more moto kids and athletes who can't do anything other than moto because they don't. And it's because they've only been doing moto since a very young age with no other involvement in other sports and in any other activity. And my personal view is you need to be a multifaceted athlete young. To me, focusing on moto at 50s and 60s and even early 80s is a mistake, because A, it becomes too much of a job for the kid at that age, and they're not going to appreciate it when they get older, when they need to put the time in. And number two, they need all these other sports to have coordination and balance. I think it helps you when you crash. I really believe so.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to add three things to what you just said. And again, we haven't rehearsed this, so let me just clarify. When we look at the multifaceted, the ability to move through three dimensions of movement, let's face it, when you do other sports, I don't care what you do, you're going to enhance that. Jet Lawrence has gotten a lot of shit because he grew up dancing, and now everybody's laughing as they look at the back of his butt patch and he goes by you and makes you look stupid. So even though he got mocked about it originally, now people are like, hey, should I put my kid in dance? I mean, you've got football teams that are putting their football players through ballet to have more finesse. The second thing that I think is missing is, because you're not multifaceted, and you already alluded to this, I'm not trying to be repetitive on purpose. I think this is what's leading to a high level of burnout, because you're kind of in this little box, you know nothing else, which segues me to my third component. And that is, I've always found that where a very high-end athlete that hangs around with other high-end athletes that sees, hey, wow, this golf lifestyle, it's hard. Hey, this football lifestyle, this lacrosse, this hockey, this soccer, wow, they can now resonate. And then I always say this, if you want your son or daughter to be the fifth next deadbeat in the neighborhood, let them hang around four other deadbeats.
100%. Yeah. But and on that topic to interrupt was, I hear, you know, kids, I work hard at moto, and I'm like, you're not in shape. Well, I'm like, dude, go do 1 week of high school football, especially here in Texas where it's brutal.
Yeah.
It's like, you won't survive. I'm looking at you. I know you won't survive. I see you on the dirt bike. I see your fitness level. I see where you're at. You don't have what it takes to do 1 week of a high school football playing and start. You might be the guy the coach says, well, go ride the bench, because you're not willing to put in the effort.
Yeah.
But these programs are intense and they're competitive.
Take it one step further. Let's keep it in moto and let's stay in line with your example. Take a kid on a 65 or an 85, fly him over the big ocean and take him to Lomel, because those kids are out there for 30 minutes on an 85 on Lomel's track. There's no such thing as a track's too sandy. It's too thick. It's too wet. It's too cold. No. I'm very fortunate. I had the privilege of, thanks to Todd Waters from Australia, he turned me on to working with an athlete by the name of Liam Owens. And Liam Owens is now racing for the Husqvarna Cat Moto team. And yeah, you're talking about a wake-up call. There's no such thing as we're not riding because it's wet and cold. No. We ride because it's wet and cold.
Right.
There's no such thing as the track. They're on a 125. They refer to them as 125s. There's no such thing as this track's not, we can't ride it because we're on a 125. They're like, you came to the wrong place, because we don't believe in that. And so, if you don't follow them, go to at Liam Owens
and check out what they do.
Well, just watch what the hell they're doing. It's astounding. And
well, is there any question that Europe is quote unquote doing it better than us now in motocross? This is why I wanted this podcast to be something that we could talk about, because I'm just seeing the decline of the American aspect of our sport. Just look at our top level. The fact that we have our top level being consistently not dominated by, but there are guys who are non-American who are consistently at the very front of our pack.
Yep.
Is, we have a huge country. We have a lot of money. We have a lot of resources. We have a lot of tracks. We have everything necessary. And we were crushing motocross when America, you know, really came up to prominence. And then it's obvious, Des Nations, United States should never lose with our size. And yet here we are getting beat by very small countries. then I think that comes down to what we're talking about, attitude and your approach to racing, how it starts young, early on in 65. That's why I really, that's really what this podcast is about for me, is to say, hey, if you do this right young, you will make a huge difference later on in the sport for your kid to be successful. I was going to ask about the, a little bit on the diet thing was, so a good diet doesn't have to be really expensive. And then secondly, what's more important, what you eat or when you eat and how much?
Definitely what you eat. I mean, it's like you building a race motor and then they put pump gas or put something else in there. Yeah. I mean, what you eat is everything. The when you eat it is what's going to make you either feel good or make you feel horrible out. I hear this quite a bit, particularly with parents with younger riders. Well, my little Johnny or Susie, we don't eat on race day because it may, they feel sick to their stomach. Well, anybody will, a vet racer or a pro rider will, if the food complexity is too high. That's why we say there's an inverse relationship between heart rate and food complexity. That's why.
And to back that up for people, by complex foods, you essentially mean, hey, is this a steak or is this something solid versus.
Don't go eat a sandwich even. I've seen people try to.
Because it's spread. It takes time to break down. Your stomach needs to digest it versus, just as an example, you have that in a smoothie that's really well blended, broken down, digested practically a lot for you. Like you said, molecule size. If it's really, 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 really tiny, your body is able to process that more easily than a big piece of
food. Well, think about where the food absorbs initially in your mouth. So when we start chewing our food, we start to actually absorb nutrients. That's a good thing. The problem is, and this is kind of a disgusting science experiment, but I would encourage people to do it. Next time you go to a restaurant, watch, observe people eat. They're shoveling.
Right.
They literally, it's in, maybe chew it twice and they gulp it. Well, now you've got these big pieces of food that are sitting in your stomach and now gastric juices has to break it down. People are hitting Rolaids and Tums. I'm not saying chew it, make it gross like baby food, but chew your food. What I always say with my clients is please put your fork down, put it in your mouth and then put the fork down.
And then give yourself time. Right.
Because you're going to absorb in your mouth. But you made a comment that I want to make sure we don't braze over. When you are looking at bringing the heart rate up, you've got to bring the food complexity down, right? And this is why you've seen the proliferation of sports drinks and energy gels and blocks. That's why the endurance market has always kind of been at the lead.
Right.
People that are running after biking 112 miles, running a marathon. Like we have athletes that go to Ironman Hawaii. And when you leave the water, the halfway point on the bike is HAV-V. So we can do a little bit more complex foods on the way there. But once we turn at HAV-V, that's what we always say. That's where the race begins, kind of like Daytona. That's when the season begins. Well, you got to think about it. From the second half of the bike ride, so for the next 50 to 60 miles, in the next 26.2, exclusively liquids.
Thing you can really process.
That's all you can process because your heart
rate's been learned. I was actually going to ask you in this question, and it ties into it, was what have you learned from endurance racing that just immediately translates over to motocross? And I'm assuming that this type of food and type of consumption is something that really correlates very well.
There would be three specific things. And again, I'm really impressed with your questions because when you look at the endurance world, the first thing is nutrition. And there's an acronym that's, it's REDS. It's relative efficiency. Relative energy deficiencies. Essentially what they're saying is if you don't eat enough food, you're essentially going to grenade your body. And they go through all the health ramifications. You lose muscular strength, power, endurance, and ultimately you end up with all kinds of like internal problems. Like think about the four external signs of adrenal fatigue.
Yeah. I was going to ask you that in a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Low libido, craving simple sugars, night sweats, tired, and you can't sleep. Well, if you look at the RED acronym, relative energy deficiencies, it's essentially saying insufficient calorie intake is going to lead to long-term ramifications. Some obvious, some not so obvious, some repairable, some not repairable.
Right. And that we'll get to that in a little bit on the repairable, not repairable side.
Yeah. So when you look at the endurance world, nutrition, these guys, they don't miss a meal. Well, they don't miss a meal.
Right.
They'll miss a workout before they'll miss a meal.
And that would be... That applies to moto too, though. Like if
it applies to every human being in the world. That's why I'm so fed up with this whole intermittent fasting bullshit. So to me, the first thing that we learned or I would take and apply from endurance into moto is nutrition. Second is periodization. You need only try to focus on try to peak only 2 to 3 times a year, hard when the race season's 11 months long. And then the third one is recovery. Everybody thinks you're a pansy if you recover. They don't know how to recover. They're advocating everybody jump in these ice baths and freeze themselves like an ice cube. There's a time and a place for it. Yes, you're going to leverage brown body fat. I get it. But the thing that I always say with an ice bath is it goes back to, if I could pull your motor out when you come off the track and you and the motor jump into a bucket of ice and the engine casings crack because of the contrast in temperature, what kind of stress do you think it's putting your body under if it just put it under the stress?
Right. So I was going to ask you on that, so those are the three things you could take away from.
Those would be the three most
three major things.
Yep.
And then my next question that I had on this, or one of my next questions, was what is periodization? So I'll break it down. That just means that you are cycling or planning out a training structure and cycle. Correct me if I'm wrong on this. That's actually how I would word it. You are planning out a training regimen and program that aligns with when you would like to peak your performance.
I like to say that, and then just make it even simpler. We're planning to win by shedding fatigue and peaking at the right time.
And we can do that how many times a year in endurance sports? You said two or three times a year was a doable.
We think about it in a calendar. We say once a quarter.
Okay.
But usually during your preseason, you're not doing one of your key right. races. So usually
parents get really screwed up. The reality is, yes, I've said this before, talent is really more important in our sport than most other sports, in the sense that if you're really talented, you can do really well despite a lot of deficiencies in other areas. Not when you go pro, though.
Yep.
But the reality is, you cannot be at your peak every weekend of the year in racing. If you want to be truly fit and you want to do really, really well as a parent, you can't have that, quote unquote, as we said, expectation of peaking every race of the year. So with that sense, we have mini O's, we have spring nationals, then we have now right now the Loretta's kind of things full swing. And then you have regionals and you have Loretta's, and then, you know, there's a couple other races out there. Is it realistic to be peaked at all of these events, or like how would you lay out a schedule if you had an athlete, your kid, your clients, and they say, look, we want the best. What are you telling them they should peak? When should they peak? You know, how many times a year, and how does that work?
It's a very, very complicated process, because I'm very blessed. I get to work with athletes who are on 85s that have good salaries and good win bonuses, right? And those big races, there's good money to be made. So I'm not in a position to tell them, hey, we're not going to peak for that race. They're like, I've got X amount of dollars that are available. What do you mean I'm not going to peak for that race? The problem is you can't physically peak for 11 to 13 races a year. If you start at the beginning of the calendar, right, you're expected to win Daytona, then they're supposed to go to Freestone, then they're supposed to go to Oak Hill, Spring-a-Ding, Area, Regional, Mammoth, AZ Open, Cal Classic, Loretta's, then come back and do World Minis. There's 11 events right there that there's quote unquote OEM. And that's what really disturbs me. I guess I shouldn't use the word disturb, but it makes me shake my head. Well, we got double contingencies. We got triple contingencies. And I understand it, parents, you know, when you can win some of your money back, that's great. But at what point, this is where I think the genesis of this whole podcast show was all about. Are we playing the short game or the long game here?
Right. That's another question, right? Like,
it's hard.
You can go with the other part. I think you hit on something. I don't know if you meant to, which was, we can get some of our money back. Well, sure. You got all these contingencies, and I don't know what they all are and aren't for every family and all the amateur deals, but I know they're not what they used to be. Like exactly. Back in the day, kids could make a living racing. Nowadays
I had an athlete that went to Loretta's, and that was at that point in time, they were giving whole shot bonuses, laps led bonuses, moto wins and championships. I have one rider on a super mini, and I have one guy in the B class. The super mini can make 60,000 in a week, and wow, the B class could make 100 grand.
Right. And that's like, if you know, the Alessi days, he quit his real job, Tony Alessi did, in order to pursue racing. And then they had enough money available to them, and that's why they race so much, that he could fund his racing and his money and paycheck by doing this. Nowadays, I mean, I might be wrong, but my understanding is that's kind of gone.
You
don't
exactly
have
right.
near that type of money involved. So at that point, what you're getting at was, we got to go do here, we got to go do there. My opinion is not of that. Number one, I think that none of these races really matter except for Loretta's nowadays. The other ones are like a feather in your cap, and they're great. But realistically, if not everybody shows up to the race, the entire country, then the OEMs don't care as much. They're like, hey, that wasn't a full gate. That won't get you a ride, even though you won. So you got to focus on maybe Loretta's and of course getting to Loretta's. And then I was going to say, after that, in my opinion, the way we've currently structured it, I just don't think that the other ones matter as much.
Well, can I rip a scab off in a really ugly way? If you look at the pros are willing to show up and race for free because they have no representation, and the promoters have gotten to a point. And if you really put this in just matter of fact terms, right, that's the whole purpose of this show, is you're not seeing mechanics and truck drivers showing up to the races for free. So we're all there to pay to watch the racers race. And with the exception of the factory guys, most of the guys are not making a good living, if getting paid at all.
Or losing money. Yep.
Or losing money. But unfortunately, as long as those guys are willing to show up and race for free, it's going to continue to happen. Let's just leave it at that for face value. Take and run with it whichever direction you want. It is what it is.
It's a fact, though. And a lot of people don't understand this.
But let's go the other direction. Why are parents willing to put up with the reduction of contingency money, right? So, and again, this is a podcast for you as parents. And if you want to engage in conversation below in comments, if you don't want to be public about it, if you want to DM Derek and I, we'd love to chat with you about it. We've been here and we've been there and done that. The OEMs have curtailed. I mean, there's some OEMs that aren't even offering contingencies, right? So why are you as a parent continuing to support an OEM and or a series when all they're doing is consistently pulling back on the support, which puts you on a faster treadmill to try to break even to get what you used to have? You're talking about putting a carrot in front of you, and we're so busy and we've kind of bought into the Coca-Cola syrup that this is the only way to go.
Well, and the crazy part is it means, like, we're navigating amateur motocross part. We would like you to be successful to win, right? But also become a pro that can be successful and make money. And that is a totally, that can be at odds. You could be the most successful amateur of all time if you wanted to be, but be a really, you know, and I say most successful, but you could be a winning amateur that had loyalty to your brands that quote unquote helped you and you stuck with loyal. And the second you turn pro, the second you leave the amateurs, you're worth nothing if they don't think you're a champion.
Well, that's
they
where I was,
will drop you.
Well, that's where I was going to go to the, if you look at it like a pendulum, right? You have pros racing for free. You have amateurs getting less and less contingency. Well, then you go to the, what you said earlier, where periodization becomes a challenge. You're only as good as your last race.
Right.
So if what I always say with my racers is, what are we going to the race to do? What are our expectations? This is a conversation I have with every single one of my clients, because we don't want dad's expectations to not be understood by the rider. We don't want mom's expectations to not, we need her to know what the rider's at. Otherwise you get the quiet treatment driving home because right. Expectations weren't met. We talked about that even on call number one. So if we come back full circle, you've got an athlete, he or she is an OEM sponsored athlete. They go to a race, they're literally trained. They've had a big 6-week block of training, but they're obligated to race it. So they race it and they get third. What's all the talking buzz? Ah, Joey's off the pace. Joey's off the pace.
Right.
Well, Joey's coming in with 6 weeks of cumulative fatigue in his body. We didn't shed, that's what a taper is. We didn't shed any fatigue because we're focusing on something in 3 months from now. And this is where the parents start to lose their mind. They're like, wait a second. As soon as we get third, we're getting called by the quote unquote OEM amateur manager going, what happened, Johnny? What happened, Johnny? What? And I'm going to go out on a limb here and I hope I don't piss anybody off, but this is what makes Daniel Blair so good. Daniel Blair has been an elite athlete. He understands the politics inside and out. He's like, it's all right. It's a bigger game. Don't worry about it. Now, of course, winners win. Nobody right. likes to lose. But if you can, this is where Daniel does a phenomenal job. If you get in front of that athlete and you say, hey, look, we're worried about 3 months from now. What I need from you is I want you to really focus on your starts in line choice. Focus on your starts in line choice. Now you have a team manager that's watching Derek Harris go around the track. He's not even looking at what place you're in. Hey, good job. Your transition, you're grabbing in the second shift, controlling the first turn, A+.
Well, that's a great point. And I was actually going to say, you know, my experience with Caden, the year that he won pro 250 pro, he was not fantastic at his area. He was not fantastic at his regional and he had a lot of injuries early in the year. So he didn't even ride for a whole bunch,
but there's a perfect example. Injuries.
He was not. Yeah. Yep. He finally, but you know, goes out in his pretty much peak form at Loretta's, I would say. And I think his year was a little off. He still did well, like, you know, from the injuries, but yeah. They peaked at the right time intentionally. And that was part of his program. You know, he had thought about that. That's something that they had thought about. Whereas you look at Hymus that year at Loretta's, piss poor. And yeah. I'm sure that, I don't know 100%, but I'm sure that probably they were in part of the grind where, hey, you know, we're expected to win. We're with Honda this year. We're going to show big things. We're going to come out on fire. And I heard they had all sorts of little issues and this and that throughout the year.
Sure.
That held him back. But he probably was going through this grind. I know he'd moved to Florida that year. He probably was not 100% used to the heat and humidity that training program puts down on you guys out there. So it's an example of why was Hymus so bad at Loretta's? But look, at pro, he is very fast. He's got some stuff going on, I think, but he's fast. There's potential there. So that's an example of when you should peak. And I think maybe a lot of people miss that. I was going to ask on that periodization a little bit was, what do you think is the performance difference between an athlete that has done that? You know, what's a percentage? Like, let's say we're doing a road bike ride, you know what I mean? Or a run. What percentage difference can there be if you do that correctly and just pure fitness talk, not just dirt bike talk, but pure fitness? What kind of difference is there when you've done that correctly versus when you're not? Because we know all Olympic athletes of every variety are doing that. They're doing the taper, like you talk about, and peaking at Loretta. So what percentage would you say is available to doing that correctly if you do it right?
Oh, you can double your output 100%. Yeah, when you shed fatigue, if we put it in mechanical terms, right? Are we going to Loretta's with a bike with 100 hours or a bike with 2 hours?
Okay, so it's essentially like taking hours off would be the analogy.
It's an absolute parallel. Okay. The difference is I can't reach in your chest and replace your adrenals. I can't reach in and replace the freshness of your quadriceps, your core, your abs.
So there is a huge difference here.
It's a difference of night and day. And what's so fascinating, and this is not a dish on the sport, but we're just having a candid talk about the challenges that these parents are facing. You don't see somebody coming into the Olympics tired.
No, and they're well rested. Yeah,
it's 4 year build with a focus of peaking, and think about how dangerous or how difficult that is, managing injuries and illness and emotional. You know, I'm very fortunate. I went to high school with a young man by the name of Hunter Kemper, and he's made 3 rounds of the Olympics for the sport of triathlon. Wow. Now think about that: 12 years of maintaining one peak race every 4 years. He was ranked number one in the world when he went into the first round of Olympics. And then, you know, you have to come off of that.
What's interesting is that those sports almost have a culture of it, though. And I might be wrong on this. I haven't followed it that closely, but
there's
I was going to say
culture.
There's
culture.
The U.S. Olympic trials, but the U.S. wants to put their best foot forward with their best athletes. And so what I think I've seen is like, they'll run a certain time at an event in Olympic trials, but they're like, even though that's your chance to qualify in and you desperately want to do that, if you're a younger athlete or haven't made the Olympics yet, in a perfect world, you would do your periodization to be peaked there. But the reality is they'll be faster at the Olympics because they're doing their cycle correctly. And so you'll kind of see them on early form, but you're not going to see them on peak form until the Olympics because they're doing that correctly. But that culture allows it. They're not actually having to be at their peak at the trials, which is interesting.
Well, and people have heard me say this on the Johnny Hopper show. We have the privilege of working with a lot of elite runners, Kenyans, Ethiopians. And what's great about them is there's a couple of things. You mentioned earlier the idea that we're just a land of plentiful and abundance and all that. When you come from a country who has nothing and they appreciate every little thing, if I had a young son or daughter, I would make them run a stock bike until they're like waiting on the bike. Until
you want to laugh about that? Here's my question for you. I had it on my list as well.
Okay.
How much focus would you put into a good, and I say good as in, which is a relative term that hopefully we'll all be able to enlighten some people on more down the road if they wish to listen.
Yeah.
Mod motorcycle versus a great, perfect stock bike. And then at what level would you say that has to shift at? So how far would you say we can be successful on a perfect stock bike? And then at what point do we really need to put emphasis in a quote unquote mod bike? So for you, you said stock, but how far along would that take you? I have my opinion. So, you know,
yeah, I think it could take you all the way to the top because to me, it's the attitude of the bike person riding the bike. And you can see this exemplified when the Ken Rocks and Pierce Brown, what's his name that he did the 85 challenge, not Pierce Brown. Carson Brown.
Yeah.
Watch them ride that 85, the attitude and the approach, right? It's you got to get out of that bike. Especially if you're using the work, it's perfect. It's balanced. The bike is handling its tracking.
It's not blowing up. It's in perfect mechanical condition. It runs 100%.
But taking it another level though, the bike is balanced. The athlete trusts what it can do.
Right.
The rider can push that suspension to its potential, literally, and is able to literally wait on the motor because he can just ring it to the moon
because he's got all he can out of it.
I'll take that athlete all day, every day.
Hey, it's funny you say that with Carson Brown when he did challenge, I think Blair did this, Seth Dennis, and they did the Super Mini Challenge. Carson rode, I believe, Blair's bike. And I'm not talking down on Blair because I don't know, but I don't think it was quite the level of engine that Seth Dennis has. Seth had, I think, a better engine. And then Seth had like a 40-pound advantage or 50-pound advantage over Carson. And I'm pretty sure the suspension was still Daniel Blair's kids' suspension that Brown rode. So it's a great YouTube video that Carson Brown raced against, you know, Seth Dennis, who's a Super Mini champ. And they were damn near even. I think, I don't recall who won, so you guys should go watch it. But having said that, they were within a 10th or less than a 10th or, you know, really close.
Yep.
But to your point, suspension's not right for Brown. motor potentially. And I'm not talking down on Blair. Maybe he has a full blown motor, but I don't think he had as good of a motor in there. And yet Brown was able to add a way heavier weight on incorrect suspension, on not a track tailored to him, pretty much go the same speed or better. I can't remember.
Or the let's just use the word stay in contact with.
Right. Yeah. And I think he might've, I don't mean, I want people to watch it. I don't recall if he won or not, but I remember being like, that's shocking. And the point to it is the bike's not right. And he's still, because he's now an adult, he's raced big bikes. He's getting everything he can get out of that bike. And it's not about the bike to him. It's about how he rode it. And so I think that that's an example where you're right. The stock bikes, I as a mod shop, it pains me to say this, but the bikes are so good nowadays that the difference between you winning and losing is not your motorcycle when it comes to like versus a stock bike. Now, the challenge is, and again, this podcast is about your side, but on my side, how often do you really know that all that you did to your bike made it better?
Exactly the question that I ask all the time. Why did you upgrade your suspension?
Is it actually better?
I didn't see you exhaust the stock stuff.
Well, when you upgraded it, you bought a kit. Okay. But is it inherently technologically better? We have YouTube videos that look inside of stock, a kit, whatever. And then number two is that setting actually better for you? And I'll give you a great example. I think I said this last time, but Caden, pre Loretta's was really struggling with some chassis stuff. And I mean, he bitched about it all year. And it's kind of the things that, you know, KTM GasGas have been going through kind of sort of right now. Right.
Yeah.
So, and his complaints were always the same. And they basically was that the bike felt marshmallowy to him. And so he would go way too stiff on the suspension to try to get rid of this feeling. And so that was just whatever his complaint was. So, you know, they were doing, I mean, they were sending suspension out weekly, right? To the same, you know, great companies work with them and did good work. But having said that, his dad was like so frustrated. He had this race bike, mod engine, a kit, all these parts and pieces, chassis stuff. And then his dad's like, go get the stock bike that's brand new that we haven't used yet. We were planning to build it, but we didn't need it because he was hurt all year, and just go do some laps. And this is literally at a Florida sand track. That's an outdoor national caliber track. That's rough and tough and whatever. And he goes and turns an identical lap time on a bike he had not rode all year. And his dad's like, what are you doing? He's like, what? And he goes, well, how's it feel? He's like, well, it's really slow. He's like, well, then how the hell is your lap time the same? And he's like, I don't know. It turns good. It hooks up good. It's got the chassis. I don't love it, but it works pretty good. And the example was that all this hard work, Caden himself being responsible for this, he had steered himself in a poor direction to where the bike just was at odds with itself. And then the bone stock bike that in his own admission was really slow was the exact same lap time on a Florida deep sand outdoor national pro level track. And it's like, hey, so his dad's going, what am I spending all this money for? Right. Yep. And that's the guy who won Loretta's that year. And this is probably, I would bet you that was 3 weeks prior to Loretta's. 3 weeks. So
it's funny you say that. If we go back to the Kenyans for a moment, right? We were talking about tapering and we were talking about the benefit of all that. The Kenyans, I'm going to tie into what you just said. When I mentioned earlier, we have the privilege of working with the Kenyans and they come from next to nothing. They're literally, their life consists of three things. They're either eating, running, or sleeping. That's it. And when
train, right? What is that shirt?
Literally. And then when they come home, they literally lay on the ground and put their feet up on the wall to have gravity pull the lymphatic fluid out of their legs. Right.
Right.
So when they go to do their work, they're ready. And the Ethiopians, they're really great people to talk to, the Kenyans as well. Their thing is, if the Americans ever take recovery as serious as all other countries, we as Kenyans and elite runners will be screwed.
Because
that's coming from a Kenyan Americans. Now
I was going to ask you on that topic, on the recovery side, which is what are some things that can prevent injury? Like when you fall and then like stretching or foam roller work, or I heard something about a term called foundations. I've heard this multiple times now. And then you had said the three-dimensional space and body per perception. So on that topic, I'm assuming that though we could ask about the prevent injury thing, but would you throw in, now that you said this, would you throw in recovery as an anti-injury mechanism?
100%. What motor's got a better chance of grenading? One with 100 hours or one with 2 hours?
And essentially recovery is taking hours off, is how we can analogy it to the human body.
There's a lot, and it's beyond the scope of what we want to talk about today. But when you look at the word recovery, it has to start with you're eating enough calories to fuel what you're asking the body to do.
Because otherwise, hourly. You've heard said this on Gypsy Tail, your body eats itself for those calories.
Exactly. If I, that's the analogy I gave on Jace as well. If I say to you, look, I'm going to save weight on the motorcycle by cutting the radiator fluid in your engine oil by half. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it saves weight, but it excessively stresses the system. And then when it grenades, people go, well, no shit, Sherlock, you're running half the oil in the engine that you should. It was on borrowed time. Well,
right. And that's like not eating enough calories. I guess especially with kids, they're growing. Hopefully the kid's not, you know, way overweight, which could be another sign or something, but like he's a fit kid. He's a raw moto kid. We shouldn't be restricting their calorie input at all.
No, hell no. Right. And that's where that Olympic, there's a couple articles that I could forward to anybody, but that's where that acronym RED comes from. Relative right. energy deficiency is a byproduct of insufficient calories. If we put it in mechanical terms, the precursor to a grenaded motor is insufficient oil
or not simple enough, or it ran out of gas midway through the motor.
Yeah. Or whatever.
I was
that
dumb.
Is.
We didn't fill it up. That's yeah. stupid. Right.
So if you look at that, this is where I wanted to go back to Caden's situation when he said it felt slow. The Kenyans, as a general rule of thumb, now you got to remember right now, we're about to see a sub 2 hour marathon, right? They're at like 204.
26 point whatever miles yeah. in less than 2 hours running.
Yeah. So now you've got a group of 10 or 15 guys that are run 2 hours and 4 minutes. You've got a couple guys that are like literally within seconds of going under 2 hours.
Right.
They have a general rule of thumb that when they run easy, they run twice as slow as their fast pace. So let's just say for even numbers, their fast pace is a 4 minute mile. They will run their easy runs at an 8 minute mile. So when you come back, now our sport's a little bit different because the equipment is designed to be under certain load for it right. to perform properly. It's a little bit different. But when you made the comment that Caden was like, hey, it feels slow, but the stopwatch shows that he's on point. This is where we get into that idea of you had a completely stock bike. What is that bike? I'm not trying to go into nebulous terms here, right? Mm-hmm. That stock bike is a fresh bike. That's a bike with no hours on it. That's a bike that's not stretched, blah, 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 mm-hmm. blah. But it was as fast as his modded bike with all the pieces and parts. Does that not validate the incredible power of being a fresh human being?
Right.
Mentally and physically, because that's where it comes back full circle. When you talked about, you know, the four dimensions of movement, right? You have the left and the, mm-hmm. excuse me, the three dimensions of movement. You have the left and the right side, the front and the back of the body, and above and below the belly button. Well, on the motorcycle, it's same thing, left peg, right peg, above and below the seat, and front and behind. We all know that from the belly button down controls the rear of the bike, and the belly button above is the front of the bike. When you start looking at, all right, what if we only were to, and the motor is the easiest one to think about, what if we just continuously keep replenishing and refreshing the top end? You still have a bottom end that's stacking hours.
Right.
And eventually you're only as strong as your weakest link and it grenades. What if you're doing a tune-up on the suspension, but instead of freshening up the oil, you leave the old oil in, but you keep putting in
yeah, right.
fresh spring, right?
Right.
You're only doing half of what a rebuild is all about.
Right.
Nobody,
they're not going to work well with that. Right.
Well, nobody mechanically would go, well, this is a double negative. If you kept the old oil and kept putting new internals and the thing blows up, you're not surprised because in mechanical terms, maybe suspension's not as graphic as if you keep building, if you keep putting a fresh top in and then you don't refresh the bottom or you don't split the casings and do the main bearing, it has a 500
hours. Has a finite life, right?
Exactly. You're only as strong as your weakest link. And that's where if you get into, and I know for the parents are like, we can get into the real deep weeds on this. Think about the word or the acronym, relative energy deficiencies.
Right.
Your athlete cannot continue to burn more than he's taken in.
So it's important that they get enough food. I was to say you mentioned it already, especially as an adult side of things, you said, but like burnout. So what are the signs? You said the external ones were obviously, I think it was like low energy, low libido.
If you're taking notes, which I hope everybody is doing on our shows, on your piece of paper, I want you to write from left to right, cell and then an arrow, tissue, an arrow, organs, arrow, system, cells, tissue, organ, system. When you finally go to let me back up. We get blood work done with our athletes once a quarter. It's the foundation of health. It's why we have our complete med solutions. People are caught into a vicious cycle. They need to know what is the health of themselves and or their athlete. If you look at that at a cellular level, you're getting a snapshot of the health. So if it says that you're out of range, this is a scary part. With all of our blood reports, it's not a report of health. It's an absence of disease. Mm. So when it says you're in range of not having a disease. That's right. Pretty scary all in itself. That's why I work with Dr. Brainy. We look at blood from an athletic standpoint, because just like your modded motor, you need certain things that a stock motor is not going to need. Well, when you're putting your body under a lot of demands, you have to know what to look for. You need to have more iron than most people think. You need to have more B vitamins than people think. So with that being said, when you wait until you get diagnosed with Epstein-Barr, the system, the final product is diseased. Why it's so frustrating is it could have been avoided if you just got a snapshot of your blood continuously, because a cell that is deficient, like for example, this will resonate with a lot of people. If you have a dysfunctional thyroid, what's the ingredient, what's the element that's usually missing in your blood? Iodine.
Okay.
It's a very easy thing to fix. So if your thyroid's not working correctly, well, you can find that with a blood result. You're like, oh wow, your iodine levels are low.
Probably it's obvious, right?
It's, but think about what's obvious. The thyroid dysfunction is a byproduct of having low iodine levels. People go, click, it makes sense. Well, why do we wait? Because I want to go back to what you said, the four external signs of adrenal fatigue, which is now a diseased system. Your adrenal system is now completely beyond repair, relatively speaking. You have low sex drive, you have craving of simple sugars, night sweats, tired, and you can't sleep. Well, those are the four external signs that validate there's an internal problem. Now reverse the whole equation. You've waited till the system is completely ripped
apart.
And
now it's really hard to fix.
It's right. Nearly impossible, because I'm not going to name any names, but I've picked up several athletes in the moto world that's in the middle of the season. Their previous trainer smoked their adrenals. And the only thing that you can do to rebuild the body is give it food and sleep. You cannot add more speed work. You can't train through adrenal
fatigue. Can't train through it, right.
At the same time, they've got a $100,000 bonus on Saturday night that's available, and they've got to be doing their speed work to be ready, but they're already so tired before they get there.
That is a huge problem in our sport that I think the GPs are better about than the US schedule at the pro side. I mean, I don't know how the pros do it, to be frank. And we'll talk on that too at some point. So I was going to ask about supplementation, and then we'll talk about other stuff. But
yeah,
the pro side is really challenging because you have a 30 some odd week schedule, I think this year, 33 or something like that, plus training and plus whatever else they have. I don't know how they do it, right? Like, I don't know how. I mean, you're obviously an elite level athlete, you're really fit, you're whatever. But at the end of the day, I think that it's almost too much. Whereas the GPs have weeks off between events, they have a longer off season, they don't have as long of a season. I think from a longevity standpoint for an athlete, as long as you can avoid the big mechanical injuries, like I broke my arm, I broke my this, I broke my that, you can have a much more successful, better and stronger career. It is actually astonishing that a Tomac exists, or that a Jason Anderson exists nowadays, or that, you know, all these guys are going as late as they are. Reed, when he did, and other guys, Justin Brayton, because our schedule is just so brutal. But at the amateur side, we're fortunate enough. And that's what that periodization question was about. Hey, you guys as amateurs know the big races. So would you say for an amateur, pick two or three that are well spread out, like you said, every quarter, that you really would like to be good at? And that's a reasonable approach to an amateur side?
It's the only approach. And what's important is making sure that the rider and the parents are on the same page.
And, and I forgot to when you said about Blair, that he gets it. I agree with that. I tell athletes all the time, if you're going to a regional or you're going to an area, let's say you're going to an area and you know that you're a Loretta's capable guy. It doesn't matter what, you know, you'll probably win if you're like a top 10 guy effortlessly. But what you should focus on is, hey, I want to rip every hole shot, because that's focusing, bringing up your level, executing in a moment of need, every single one at the area. Maybe you don't have to do everything else great, but that's something you really focus on. And like you said, great line selections. Or let's say you're working on technique that time of year, because you should be, okay, I'm going to stand up. If you're clearly the fastest guy there, I'm going to stand up the entire lap, a couple laps, and see if I can work on that. Or I'm going to work on whatever, no clutch, or I'm going to work on, you know, whatever it is. And then come regional time, same idea. You just have to qualify. So if you're at a guy that has the speed, you know, you're there. Okay. Same thing. I would like to rip off every hole shot I possibly can as practice, because I need this for Loretta's. Number two, you know, if I'm out front leading, I'm going to ride my own laps, my own pace. And if somebody passes me going around the slow line in the track, hey, good for them. But as long as I'm in qualifying position, we're there. You know, if I'm not 100% peaked, I can't give it my all. My body's not quite there yet. With the vision being that Loretta's, we will be there. But also you can use that as a chance to learn, right? How does a track get rough? I always tell people, if you're not the regional, you should kind of be close on your bike. Like the bike should be close. But you need to use that opportunity that track gets rough. It's rutted. It's race pace. It's race conditions. It's C class and B class and A class and all the other classes. So the lines develop the way that they do at race days.
Yep.
Use that as an opportunity to make your motorcycle better when you lead into Loretta's, not just, I got to go win. And well, I think that's missed.
Well, that's why we do race day simulation on the physiological side. We're testing sweat rate. We're testing calorie burn rate. We're testing intensity. We look at average and max heart rate. We look at the science of the human being. We look at that telemetry. But if you think, let's go into a completely different sport that I think would be a good example for all the listeners. How is Michael Phelps supposed to be on point on the starting blocks? Let's just assume it's his first time going into the Olympics, right? We can sit here as an industry and we can say, when you go to that track, try to imagine that you're on the gate with 39, 41 other dudes at Loretta's. Put yourself in that environment. Well, it's kind of nebulous. It's kind of difficult. But then when we go to, like, again, going back to Michael Phelps, how do we know that he's rehearsed it enough times in training and has executed it in an environment where the pressure was on? But go to those saying, hey, look, we don't really care how we swim in the water. Right now, we know in training, your speed, you can win today. That's fine. What we want to do is make sure that you're really focusing on your starting technique. Because if you come off the blocks a tenth of a second or a hundredth of a second off the mark, all right. So now Michael Phelps is getting up there. He knows when he gets in the water, he's going to haul the mail. That's fine.
But he wants to execute the other details that just swimming.
But how do you create an environment that has the same level of pressure without it being the Olympics? Well, you've got to go into it and put the pressure on yourself.
On yourself, which is hard to do.
Well, that's why I'm saying you're worried about the end result. So now he shits the bed on the start, but because you've got to win the race, he's just getting to the front of the pack, which he's already good at doing that. Right. That's not what you're there for. If you see on Struggle Bus that your athlete is not transitioning over the gate, grabbing a second shift,
right,
grabbing the front brake and owning the first turn, then you go and you race every class you can and only focus on transition, second shift, and first turn.
With a purpose, right? So get better at your weaknesses.
Eliminate your weaknesses,
right?
Because everybody's goal should be like, you're a much better rider than I am. So my only way to beat you is expose your weaknesses. Ricky Carmichael says it with James all the time. I just had to pressure James into a mistake or I would never win. Right. So what we always say is convert your weaknesses to strengths, race your strengths to expose others' weaknesses. And you do that from 85s to A1.
And you hit the nail on the head that if you're watching this podcast, you should always be focusing on your weakest links early on. Because, and like you said, turn a weakness into a strength. So something you're not good at, make it something you are really good at. And then now something that was a strength becomes a weakness and you work on that.
Well, shift it. If you don't fix your weakness, everyone's going to keep beating you at the same weakness because they know Michael Lessi Villopoto. The race results were always the same because of the way they approached it. You could go through everybody and anybody. We saw it a couple summers ago when it was Sexton and Tomac, right? Mm-hmm. It was whoever made the least amount of mistakes was going to win. They were 40 seconds ahead of everybody.
Yeah.
We're seeing it with Jet. Depending on when you guys watch this show, the Daniel Blair show, what race do we have? St. Louis this weekend. So whatever round number we're on, depending on when you watch this podcast, if you don't follow the Daniel Blair show, it's his show that he puts out the Wednesday before every race. He did about a 4-minute segment in his show about Levi Kitchen and the fact that he sat out, he stayed in the 125 class, he stayed back, he put a ton of pressure on himself. He was the oldest guy in the class. And he talks about how he navigated, no pun intended, he navigated the success to win at Loretta's, which got him the star ride. So it's everything that we've spent, how long we've been together here, an hour and a half today. Daniel Blair surmises it. It's where Derek and I are talking about this in more of a hypothetical type situation. Yes, we've experienced it one-on-one, but if you want something in real time that you guys are watching on TV, Daniel Blair broke down Levi Kitchen's path of getting to where he's at.
Well, and that's exactly, you know, what amateur motocross is, and Deegan said this perfectly well, so how important is it to win on Gypsy Tales? And they said, well, it's really not because it doesn't matter as a pro. Your amateur accolade, look at Jet Reynolds, means nothing. Mm-hmm. The kid was unbelievable as a young amateur. And yet now here he is hurt and not that successful. And I hope he can be, right? Like the talent's probably in there. It just has to put it together. But having said that, what it does do, what the Deegan said, was being successful at the right time in amateurs gets you the ride. And the ride is very, very important in pro. And it's challenging, but it's very, very important because without the ride, you're going to spend a lot of money. You're going to be up against the wall in the equipment side. Like, people don't understand, but if you're trying to build a bike that's competitive at that level, if you're going to do it on your own, there's almost no amount of money that will compete with the amount of money that the teams are spending on that type of stuff. So when you're trying to beat Mitch at PC, you're trying to beat Star at Yamaha or Honda, they have multiple millions of dollars of budget and years of millions of dollars of budget behind that product and a lot of great people and staff. And that's their sole job, to be the best bike they can. So it's tough. That's where amateurs is important, is to navigate it, peak at the right times, do it at the right time to get the ride. That's really what the show's about. And, you know, also be a good pro. Don't burn yourself out on those. I'm not burning yourself out was, as an amateur, how fit can you really be? Can you be full, like a triathlete might be? Like, can you be fully peaked, fully fit for multiple years in a row without any burnout?
Oh, absolutely. The burnout comes from not taking any breaks. That's what we just spent an hour talking about. It's knowing when to break, how long to break. What do you do during that break? Like, so for example, with my clients, they take one rest day per week. They take 1 week of rest per block, and that block could be anywhere 6 to 8 weeks. And then they take a 4 week off season every year.
Okay. And that's huge. I actually think,
but when it falls into place,
4 week off season.
Well, that's where people freak out. If there's anything I get more resistance from, believe it or not, is the rest days, the rest weeks, and the off season, because people are like, it seems counterintuitive. Why would I take a rest? Why would I take some? And you think about the off season comes when you're at your last peak of the year, which if everything goes well, you just had the best race of the year. And now
you're on a high.
Right. Now you're going to pull the parachute. This is where moto dads want to kill me.
Right. They're
like, we're finally coming. We're right where we want to be. And now you want them to take 4 weeks off. Yes. But here's where I have to earn the trust of the listeners. You have to go through a year of seeing how rest creates a catapult effect. And when you experience the catapult effect at the end of the year, you're going to love the catapult effect, but it requires that you start with an off season, come in detrained, elevate your fitness preseason, elevate your fitness pre-competitive season, elevate your fitness competitive phase one, phase two, phase three, peak, end of season, off season.
And then next year, you'll notice after that you're higher after. Next year and higher next year.
But that literally, and I have this gentleman's permission because we just talked about it this week. Richard McEwen is one of my pro athletes out of the UK. He's raced MXGPs. His parents own the Desert Martin racetrack, which was on the MXGP circuit in Northern Ireland. He said to me verbatim, he just did very well at one of the Scottish rounds this past weekend. And he said, Rob, what I never took serious was how much you put an emphasis on those rest days. And on the days that you wanted me to stay in zone two, I went into zone three, maybe even zone four. He says, this last year, I've done it exactly. It's not about me. Don't take it out of context. His whole thing was, I've realized that I went too hard on my easy days, which I preach about all the time. And he's like, I can't believe the difference. He goes, I'm beating people this year that I didn't beat last year. And I worked harder last year. And I'm like, well that's because you've got the foundation.
Right? I've experienced that as a moto guy. And then like as a competitive sports guy, when I was a kid and played all the sports, is like,
yeah,
I have a really hard time on an easy day trying to go easy. You don't feel like you're working.
Yes.
Now I'm out of shape, so I'd probably have a great time doing the easy days. But back in the day, it's like I would just so struggle. Like, oh, you know, I'm feeling great today. I want to wick it up a little bit, just a little bit. No, mm-hmm. It's like, no, you know, it's so hard to discipline yourself to do that because you don't realize that it is doing work,
yes.
But it takes time. So I was on that kind of topic was, have you learned anything in like the past? You've been at this for what? I don't mean to belie your age, but 30-ish years, right?
30. This is my 39th year as of March of this year. 39
years. So
39 years.
Have you learned anything in the last 39 years that have dramatically changed opinion on that, you know, from originally on and to now you're like, wow, this is something we've learned totally different. That's the first question of a kind of a continued one.
Yeah, I would say it goes back to recovery. And I said it, and I have to give credit to the Olympic Training Center. Because for them, like when we were talking about the biofeedback numbers and, you know, they because we slept with electrodes, they would get our sleep analysis and they look at our resting heart rate and stuff like that. When they would literally not let us train. And I got butt hurt on that. I'm like, what, you think I'm too soft? You know, you think I'm not. And it was like he said, because it's the exact opposite. He goes, you're so tired. All we're going to do is either suppress your immune system and you're going to get sick or you're going to get injured.
Wow. So like that's. It's the mentality that you're just belying to the mentality of somebody who wants to be successful. It's like you can grind yourself to less success or sickness or illness or whatever. And you just have to understand that that's how important recovery is. So you would say you would double down on recovery.
Well, if I took any of the listeners, athlete, either you as an athlete or as a parent, if I took a young athlete and I said, All right, I'm going to have you wear a heart rate monitor, but I'm going to turn it backwards so you can't see the number. I want you to give me 5 laps, easy. Get the lap times, we get the heart rate data. They come in, I was like, all right, fully rested, recovered. I want 5 laps at your fastest speed. There'll probably be less than a second deviation between the two, because it goes that's back true. To what you said. And that's because we get geared, we literally get programmed to just one gear. Now, I'm not naive. I understand that the bike needs to have a certain amount of load for the suspension to do its job.
Right, right.
I get that.
Right.
But when we ask somebody to please go out and ride at 85%, when I write the protocols on the motorcycle, I'm writing them from the standpoint of a physiologist. I'm not arguing whether or not you have one finger on the front or 2 fingers on the front. I don't care. I don't care when you sit down. I don't care if you stand up in a rut. That's between you and a riding coach.
Right.
I'll always make that declaration. The difference is people are not approaching it from a physiological standpoint. And that's exactly my direction as a company to change the health and the direction of the sport. I've got a couple of private investors that want me to build a race team, and they have for a couple of years. The way that we're building the race team is the race team will be built around the athlete. We will not be OEM funded. We will be outside the sport funded, buying the bikes that I could have. Our goal is to have 4 riders. Those riders, if they want to ride a Hodaka, a Can-Am,
whatever.
They ride whatever they want. We're going to give them the bike that they want. We're going to work exclusively with you with motors and suspension. We're going to get that person comfortable. I don't care what it is. I don't care how upside down and backwards, how unorthodox it is. I'm going to provide for my investors a group of riders that are on reliable, well-balanced, well-handling bikes. I'm promising to my investors 4 athletes that are healthy, and we have 2 people in the rafters as a backup. So if somebody does get hurt, stuff happens in racing, we've got an immediate backup. They're riding the same equipment, whatever bike they want, but the same equipment is going to be kept fresh, just like they're going racing.
Right.
Right. So now we've built a team where what we're able to do is we're going to build a team that's athlete-centered, that's based on longevity. You're going to make sure that they're comfortable with the bike. They're going to understand. And then the outside sponsors, what we're going to be using it for is a completely different reason than why people go racing. And I'm not going to talk about it right now because we'll talk about it in the future. Mm. But the goal is to do things differently. The definition of insanity is doing something different, thing. Expecting a different result.
So if I were to summarize so recovery is super, super important, right?
It's the most important. It's
has there
important
been a
than
huge advancement in the last, like from the 90s or 2000s or, you know, 10s or now? Has there anything you've witnessed? I mean, obviously the watches and that's got to be a huge advancement, just the AI type metrics. Is there anything else that you've seen, or is it maybe, and I hate to say this, but like supplementation or what we know on the medical side or, you know, things like that, that have just taken a leap forward from the 90s? Cause like you said, marathoners, triathletes, these people are running the best they've ever run. They're getting faster and faster, which really, I don't think they've evolved faster, right? They're figuring things out just a little bit better. They're finding, you know, they're finding 0.1% every year.
Well, there's 2 sides to your answer. If you're looking at the advancements of performance, you would say the performance enhancing drug side of the business, being able to get around curtailing the testing results, even at the Olympic level. And we're not going to go down that bunny trail today, but the advancements on that side is what's really changed our sport the most significantly from a sustainability standpoint year after year. But that's not what I want to focus on. On my side of the equation, it would be the wearable devices. So for example, we just started in 2024 here. We've been working the last 5 years on a group. It's what we call a block of performance services. I mentioned one of them earlier today where we can look at your sweat. We can evaluate it and then we can integrate it. So that's why I started a sports drink company 6 years ago now. We now have been doing all kinds of beta testing where I can now help you as a parent. Okay, your athlete's sweat rate is this. This is what they're losing. Let's put a drink together that's specific for them. That's number one.
Right.
The second side of it would be ways that we can evaluate blood sugar. These are performance services that you're going to be hearing more about.
Okay.
We're in the final stages of beta testing, and we've been testing them with our endurance athletes for about 6 years now. I feel like they're at a point where we can bring them into moto, and moto is different because of our gear, the jolting, that all kinds. So when you look at being able to stabilize blood sugar levels, we've got one device that we're working with where we can actually monitor core body temperature to keep the athlete from overheating and having a heat stroke, just like a motor. If your athlete succumbs to heat, he or she is going to lose strength, power, and endurance. So
you think on the heat side, I mean, everybody's susceptible to it, but I had found that the more fit you get, the less heat does become a problem, especially when you touch on the factors that you touched about: proper hydration, proper electrolytes, proper. Because to me, like, if you really struggle in the heat all the time, A, you haven't been used to it, right? So maybe you haven't trained in it. But two, I think a lot of times is like, well, if the heat just kills you, well, guess what? You might just not be fit enough. And I think, is it, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't heat, your cardiovascular system plays a huge role in getting rid of heat. So if I'm not mistaken, when it's really hot out, that's why you get a little bit flushed, is your heart and your capillaries and all that are trying to get heat away.
Yeah, the whole exothermic process is always engaged at full tilt. And that's just getting internal friction and heat externally wicked away at the skin. But what makes our sport so difficult is we've got every square centimeter of our skin is covered, which retards the ability to dissipate heat. And then you add the temperature of the bike and all that goes with it. So if you go back just a smidge just for a moment, though, when you say fitness and being able to handle heat, absolutely, because below your skin, you have fat. You have fascia, then you have body fat, adipose tissue, then you have the muscle. Well, anytime there's a layer of body fat, that's going to be an insulation blanket. It's going to cause you to retain heat. So yes, fitness plays a role, but I'll give you an example. At the time of this recording, just 2 weeks ago, we had one of our opening rounds in what's called the T100, which is a new triathlon series. It's essentially a 60K race between swim, bike, and run. And they held it in the Homestead race car track.
Okay.
It's an invite only. 20 pros, and on the men's side, don't hold me to the exact number, but I think six of the men succumbed to heat stroke. And these are the fittest athletes in the world.
Right.
On the women's side, I think there were four. So if you do that as a percentage, like you were saying, fitness,
that's 10%.
They have it checked off, right? We know they're fit, but the heat and humidity zapped them because they came from all over the world. So,
and they're not used to it. And I would be willing to bet, and I could be wrong here, but I do know that when it's hot out, your heart rate's more elevated than when it's cooler out. I also know, I've read a paper on this. I think Lance's team studied this, but it was like core temperature and athletic performance. And as it goes up, your performance precipitously falls off. And you need to understand that, because if you're hitting numbers that you're used to at home, but it's 50 degrees out and it's dry and it's beautiful, and then you're out at this triathlon and it's hot and it's humid, you can't hit the same performance numbers that you would do at home. Your body can't do it.
You don't want to hit the same numbers because, and this is something that people don't understand. Like in the triathlon, it's a little bit easier because it's a three and a half hour race. You've got to literally manage yourself to get to the finish line with nothing left.
Right.
So yeah, you can burn some matches on the bike, but you're going to pay the price on the run. It was 11 laps on the run. You could light it up and catch up with everybody in the first four laps, but you still have seven left to go.
Right.
That's where our racing is a little bit different. You know, I know for some people.
Actually, I was going to say, one thing I do think that motocross athletes that aren't cross training, and secondly, not doing long endurance type trains, so like a road bike or a long run, or I'm assuming a row, or things that are taking, you know, a long period of time, it teaches you how to manage your output level.
Well,
so
you,
first you've getting
got
into that,
to. You've yeah, got you, to.
But a lot of people in the dirt bike only know go.
Well, that's the
problem. They've only ever known go as hard as you can until you can't go any harder, and then just push through to the finish line and you're in just basically just dead.
Exactly.
It's like, hey, you got to learn to manage your body, your output, in order to become a pro, in order to do 20 minutes, in order to do 25 minutes at Loretta's in the hot and the heat. You have to have a metered output of your body. You can't just do this. I'm going to sprint out of the blocks, do 100 and beat everybody, and then try to hang on to the 400. It's not going to happen.
Well, and that's where I always challenge athletes. Is your late race fatigue a strategical error, or is that a fitness issue?
Because you could be the fittest person in the world, like you said about these triathletes, but if you go out and light those matches, which is really an endurance athlete term, but I lit a couple of matches, I went into the red zone a few times. If I do that too many times too early, there is no recovery for you. You cannot come back from that.
Well, it's not just you, Derek. It's anybody who breathes oxygen and has red blood cells in their body. Because once you go past that threshold known as anaerobic, the only direction you can go is slow. Because you think about it like a rev limiter. You've gone into red line and the heart rate's got to come back into a mode of, hence the word aerobic.
Right.
And you're going to be almost at a crawling pace just to catch your breath. Well, by the time you get back into the oxygen mode, those guys are already a lap ahead of you.
And I had learned that through training personally, just as an anecdote, was like, you know your lactic threshold numbers when you train a lot. And this is why people need to, like I said, I think you need to endurance train to learn these numbers. Cause then on the dirt bike, when you put your heart rate monitor on your chest and you watch it, you start to correlate things that you didn't realize. Oh, wow. For me on a 35 minute moto, arm pump is when I go past my lactic threshold multiple times or a little bit too high. But if I back my heart rate down, I don't hit that. That's not true for everybody, but learning your numbers is so critical. And so like on a road bike, you know, you could, if you're in a group ride and it's a hill climb or so this or that, you know, and some guys are trying to break you, not break you, you know, your numbers. Hey, I just can't go with that guy. If I push you this number, I might not be able to recover. And then sometimes they were playing that game and then they push you their numbers and you catch them back on the backside. Or you get like, when you get the most fit I ever got, I could go light those matches 4 or 5 times in a 3 or 4 hour ride. I knew that, hey, I can recover quickly. You know, when you're really, really, really fit, you can go into red zone, hop back. And if you get a little bit of recovery, you're recovered and you're back at it. But you got to know that on the dirt bike is like, okay, I have the ability today. I'm in really good shape. I'm peaked at the right time. I'm hydrated. I'm feeling good. Today's a day at Loretta's, for example, if that was your choice, or a Spring National, I can lay it on the line. And if it's date late in the moto, I can push through my peak a few times. I know the white flag's out. I'm below my number. I can push to the finish line. I have that reserve in me. But if you don't do that type of training, you'll never know because you don't know your limits.
Well, and it's important that you say that because that's what we refer to as the overload principle. Every athlete that I take to Loretta's is fit enough to do a 40-minute moto because 20 feels like a short little race. And like with our pros, it's the same thing. I mean, they're not going out and doing an hour, but we're 45 to 50-minute motos. And this is, again, what a lot of the Europeans have so much dialed. It's nothing for those guys to do a 40, 50-minute moto. And I've got dashboards that, you know, right. it's not them giving us lip service. You look at their dashboard, they start, their heart rate gets into, now don't worry about the number because everybody's max heart rate number is a little bit different, but these guys will sit 80, 180, 185, and they'll sit there for 48 to 50 minutes on a motocross track,
right,
on a 2.5, 3 minute lap.
And they're trained to do it. They know their numbers. They know how to manage their threshold.
It.
Right. They know how to manage this threshold. I actually had a great friend named Jason Doyle. If he ever watches this, great. Was a Texas pro, came from Minnesota, never quite had the speed. He was a pro when the timed qualifying came about, right when that came about. And so it screwed him because if he'd ever made a national, he'd have been top 20. He's the most fit human I've ever seen on a dirt bike. And I've seen a couple others since, but he was unbelievable. But here in Texas, he did his thing and then he would train and ride on the weekends. He was actually how I got to get better, learning a lot from him. He would run his bike out of gas intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about 40, 42, 43 at 100, 105 degree here in Texas. It'd be humid. And then he would push it back as kind of his like cross training. And then I learned a lot about cooling off for him, the importance of core temperature, the things that we talked about here. The second he got back, boots off, helmet off, gloves off, gear off, inside, cooling off, not staying outside in the heat, like those types of things. When he got a full recovery and his heart rate was right and he got his fluids in and his food in, okay, I'll go do another one of those. But it wasn't like until all that was met. But having said that, he, like you said, it's funny you say that he lived for that. He's like, oh man, I just don't really feel like I'm alive.
That's right.
So I'm pushing that 40 minute threshold, you know? And I'm like, I hate you. I hate these things. You know? I can't do this. So yeah, well, that's amazing.
This is what takes us into another realm of our performance services is we have the ability to not only measure core body temperature, but how do we manage core temperature when it's hot, it's humid. And we've got some additional things like how we measure blood sugar levels and we've got like even some blood lactate analysis. And so if we come back to your original question, those different services that we are bringing in is designed to elevate the overall program. And that's where now the team element starts to make more sense. Our coaching network makes more sense. Our facility network makes more sense because if you come back to what we said about earlier, I want to put together a point system where I'm evaluating amateur athletes based on their accomplishment, difficulty of races, who they raced against, because that's what the agents are asking for. And at the end of the day,
can you show me that he can be good? Well, who's he beat? Where has he beat him? What type of track is it? Pro?
Yes.
Is it going to make him pro ready? These are tough challenges, right? Tough questions. And we've seen both sides pan out where you have an amateur that was an elite amateur doesn't pan out. And then you have a, maybe not so elite, you know, a great example of this would be amateurs that maybe weren't so great that are becoming good. Well, how do you figure that out? And an example to that would be Cameron McAdoo, not a storied amateur. And there's a couple out there. We actually have quite a few
right now.
Not that fantastic as amateurs that now have figured it out at pro. Mm-hmm. So that's a testament to the right building, the right program, the right mental attitude will develop you into a good rider. So I had a couple last questions. We've gotten really long on this one and I want to thank everybody for watching and thank you for all your answers.
Absolutely.
These ones are kind of quick if you can. So who's your favorite pro to date of all time and why? And it can be more than one if you want.
Yeah. For me, I would go back to Jeff Stanton. He's a guy that didn't, you know, just ooze with a lot of raw talent. He's a salt of the earth guy, hard worker, not a shit talker. His disposition kind of matches my work ethic. Let your racing do the talking. I love how he invested his money. Everybody's envious of his thousands of acres in Michigan. You know, on social media, he's posting, he's just enjoying the retired life. Like, of all the pros that I can think of, has anybody walked into the sunset and done it as well as he has? And I'm sure there's a lot of, I'm sure there'll be some people
would
that have
you have
some
a
examples.
Modern rider that younger athletes would refer to? Like, who's a current one that maybe even racing today that you really respect, or a couple of today, or you know, like that of current ones? Anybody that comes to mind?
Yeah, the one that, and I have a bias because I had the privilege of working with him, would be Dunge, because
I agree with
Dunge,
that.
yeah, Dunge was a no bullshit guy. He was all about do the work, and then he wanted to go home and be with Lindsay and not talk about riding. He did a great job of balance. He's a family man. He's his wife's husband, and he takes that job seriously. Being a dad,
so
he takes that
on that
seriously.
Topic, who's on your Mount Rushmore in motocross? And I'm going to have some really controversial points on this one, on my side. So who's your Mount Rushmore? And it's four on Mount Rushmore. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I hate to be the same stereotypical that everybody else has got, you know, the James, the Rickies, the McGraths of the world. I think you have to do it almost on a per decade basis, because
that makes sense.
There's no way you can say, at least in my opinion, I don't think that you can say that McGrath was better than DeCoster. And there's no way that you could say that James wasn't as, or that McGrath was better or worse than, say, Ricky or James. And then, my gosh, you add in there Chad. And then you look at nowadays, what do we say about a Tomac and his domination and his numbers?
So
and then,
that's my controversial take would be,
yeah,
I used to not really think Dunge was the guy. I used to think Villopoto was just better. But when you look at their holistic body of work, all things combined, and then you take in a couple factors. So, for example, Dungey lost a Supercross title on paper because his chain came off at a race.
Mm-hmm.
He had a mechanical, and then he had lost an outdoor title on paper because he had two mechanicals. At Freestone, he ran out of gas on the last lap chasing Villopoto, but right there.
Yep.
And then he had a stator failure at Southwick that he managed to come back to a seventh from basically a lap behind. But if you go look at the points and how close it came down to the last race with two mechanicals. So like, he probably would have won that title. So then you go, wait a second, you add a Supercross title and an outdoor title against Villopoto, who would have been the only contemporary of his that maybe could beat him consistently. Obviously at Supercross he did. And you go, wait a second. And then on top of that, he had just as many, I mean, you think he's like, how many Supercross titles do you have? Four, three?
I don't remember. I have to go
he's
look.
Got quite a few. And then he's got like a lot of outdoor titles too. If you go look at the stats, you go, wait a second, I forgot he won that many. And then on top of that, he beat everybody at one point in time. He beat Kenny, he beat Tomac, he beat RV, he beat James. Like, you're literally looking at a guy that beat everybody, whether or not you think they're their prime or not. And I think, you know, RV and them were. So he in my mind after the fact, when I started thinking about it, was like, man, he has to go on Mount Rushmore. And then number two is like, if Tomac had won Supercross last year, because I would not have put him on there, because he's been beat by all these guys. But on any given day, he's like the fastest guy. You know, we've always been able to say that. But if he had won that title last year, he'd had a compelling argument to say that he is one of the best to, you know, to do it. So then lastly, my crazy take goes that I don't think James goes on it. I just think he was the fastest dude we've ever seen. I think he was unbelievable on a bike skill. He changed the sport without a doubt. So he's most influential guy in our sport outside of like McGrath or something. But when it comes to like, when you look at the Mount Rushmore, I kind of like think of a Dungey or a Tomac or a McGrath and a Carmichael kind of supplant it. So that's mine. That was my question of that. And
well,
then
hold on real second, real quick. For the sake of the parents and what this show is all about, the one thing that I'd like you to think about Dunge is his marketability. How many people in our sport were on a Wheaties box? He had earbuds tied in with a promotion with Target. So he had not only Target, which he had on the bottom of his palm, he had his own standalone displays in Target for earbuds. He had the hair cuttery. We haven't seen that kind of outside the sport sponsors on an individual until we saw Kenny Roczen come in, who has Bretland watches. He's been in,
he was in Sports Illustrated, right? And so was Dungey.
But what's the men's magazine?
Men's Health? GQ?
GQ. He's been in GQ. He's got his own cologne line, or he's been he's contracted with it. We haven't seen anybody that's got that. I mean, Kenny Roczen showed up in a suit to a press conference and got mocked because his exact words were, I'm just trying to take it up a notch. You know, Formula One shows up, they're dressed nice. So when you look from a marketability standpoint, I think you've got to give Dunge another nod. He wasn't somebody that loathed the responsibility of being a champion. He didn't.
And that's something that parents need to grasp too, is attitude matters.
Yes.
Because most parents don't know this, but when you go pro, you are obligated to do all sorts of things outside of racing. Mm-hmm. So these pros do dealer signings and do all these events you may not even be aware of that they have to do, that adds a lot of headache to your life, to your day, to your time frame, and sponsor thank yous and dealer thank yous and meet and greets and all these things. And you do not want, a team does not want to hire you if you have a bad attitude about that. Your kid yep. needs to be, here's a great, you talked about marketability with Dungy. You're right. He was so marketable. And that's why I think he just, teams loved him. He was so always in demand because he was 100% marketable. So two points on that.
And he started a foundation for Pete's sake. With the exception of Jimmy Button, no riders ever started a foundation. So
here's a great point on that Dungy side is, if I see this all the time. I actually had a little Instagram spat with a kid the other day. I think it's hilarious. And I love to spat. So if you want to spat with me and you get me, right? Just go for it. I think it's great. I mean, again, I'll tell you, kids can talk the best crap I've ever seen in my life. It's awesome. So we talked this another show. You go to a race and you see a parent and a kid who have a sponsor of whatever, a bike, a suspension, a this, a that, a part, and then they're bad mouthing it behind the scenes. And all their friends know about it and everybody knows about it. And you go, I would never sponsor that kid. And then they don't realize that, like, here's my company and other ones who are going to see that. And word flies through the pits like wildfire. People don't get that. It's like that company knows he's bad mouthing them. So at the end of the day, it's like, hey, if you want to be marketable, you need to be marketable 100% of the time, such that even if you're unhappy, the other company you do want to work with wants to work with you.
That's right.
That's super important. So Dungy had that like in spades. You never, you know, he would nitpick the bike a little bit, but here's a great question. How good was the Dungy KTM in reality? People assumed that it was fantastic because, oh, he's won all these titles and now Webb's going to go there and he's going to win and yada, yada, yada. I think the can of worms, but you never heard that bad from Dungy. It might be, yeah, we're a little missed off the setup a little bit. We're going to work on it. Team's great. And then he went, bike's great. Thanks to the team. And he did the right things.
Mm-hmm.
And he complained about the bike a little more than we had historically. I think Villa was really good about it. But having said that, all of a sudden now it's like, man, the bike must've just been a pile of crap because all these other guys have really struggled and they're still struggling, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So he did that really well. And you have to understand that's your job. You're selling motorcycles. That who primarily pays your bill.
That's right. No, I couldn't agree with you more. And his work ethic off the bike was the same. You know, he showed up, he was on time. He worked hard. He did exactly what he was asked. He reaped the benefits of it. He was appreciative, always said thank you, always shook your hand, gave you a bear hug. So,
and that goes a long, long way. The impressions you make on people around you. And then, like, I'll give this credit to Caden. If you work with him, you see him, you want to work for the kid.
Yep.
He is somebody that I will go to battle with because he has earned that respect from me. And it's just hard to even describe to people how important that is. Like, I mean, he's just an amazing human. And that's what it takes to get, if you want, like Chase said this, he was going about Honda the wrong way the year before, which really slights the team. So even though he realized it and changed his mentality, you know that those wounds were still there, which was you're hard on them, you're critical on them. The team doesn't want to work for you. No. You can be hard on people and critical of them if you rally them behind you. Hey guys, I really appreciate your hard work. Let's keep working, let's keep grinding. You're doing good. As opposed to the bike sucks. I don't think you're doing a good job. I'd like to get another guy. And I think he realized that. So that's great. But as an athlete, you have to realize you got to rally the troops, not piss them off.
Well, you got to think about it. Why did Jay Dungy leave Sexton as a factory mechanic? He left Honda to go to KTM to get away from Chase. How many mechanics has Chase Sexton
leave
through?
Honda? Right.
How many practice mechanics has Chase and his dad gone through? It's one thing to be, and this is something that I struggle, and we can do a show on this because I think it's incredibly important. Just because you're on that ascend up, all of a sudden, it's interesting, and Derek, you've seen it way deeper than I have. You go from, you watch the transition of a family, appreciate, then they become demanding, then they become intolerable. Why do you do that? And if you've ever watched, and
so what is that, big-headedness, right?
Well, I just think, unfortunately, it's, I believe that people treat you the way you let them. So if I was an OEM or if I was a manager, I wouldn't put up with the shit that these guys dish out. I don't care that you're the number one guy. And I understand that you could quit and go for another team. But at some point, if I'm Lars and I'm at Honda and I see you shitting all over everybody just because you're the top dog, even if you're the top dog, it doesn't give you permission to be disrespectful to other people. That's just common courtesy. But you can go through our entire sport where people go from appreciating to being demanding. And then as long as they're still winning, everybody just kind of catwalks right around the whole thing. And I have a severe problem with that, because at the end of the day, those people are trying to make your job easier. They're trying to, like I always say, like, I'm not going to beg an athlete to do the work. If you've got a $150,000 bonus available to you on Saturday and you're negotiating with me on the workout, hey, if I do this and this, can we do less motos? Can we do less mileage? No, this work needs to be done. I'm not going to beg you to become a millionaire is my point.
Right. You got to want to do it.
Well, and I just think, unfortunately, our industry is the type that there's a little, they'll say that there's a sign of some talent. Well, that all of a sudden it becomes a horrible environment where now you've got a contract and now the parents are getting very, very arrogant and they're becoming very demanding. And then all of a sudden you get hurt a couple times and now you're not that top dog.
Well, now the parents, what is that expression? Everybody you step on the way up is somebody that will kick you on your way down or whatever. Yeah. Well, and it's like, the reality is, if you were that person and then things, you know, you get that little success early on in amateurs, maybe, and then you get a little cocky and all that, and then all of a sudden things don't go your way. Guess of all the people that watched and saw that were like, nah, not my thing. And now your rise to prominence is much harder. I had one last question. We'll sum it up for you. So I had two, actually, and this, I think you just nailed one. Is there one thing you could change about amateur motocross and families in general? If it was short, what would that be? If you could just, one thing from 30,000 feet, and we can deep dive on that in another podcast, maybe.
I'm going to give you two of them, even though you only asked for one. Number one is appreciate everything that's been given to you and don't jeopardize your parent child relationship for any reason whatsoever.
Do you think that, we talked about this, but I think parents do need to be a coach and push at times, which is, it makes a contentious relationship somehow. So I always say the kid needs to realize that maybe you are who you are at the track or at whatever event we're trying to do. And then we leave it at the track and we go be humans and family away from the track. And if you can really separate the two, then life can be successful.
100%.
Okay. Last question for you. When's the last time you rode something that was powered and had two wheels, and what was it?
It was my YZ250 in 2004.
Okay. So I mean, that all, like, or we're talking e-bike, anything. So,
no, I take that back. I have a Harley. That I have. The company owns a.
And when's the last time you rode that?
Just yesterday. I ride it every day.
Oh, I was gonna say. And so, when every time you ride something with two wheels that's powered, and it could be a scooter, it could be whatever, do you smile?
100%. And I love it. Where we live, there's a lot of two lane roads, so we take it to the gym every day, and it's nice because it's a nice little quiet ride. Even though we live on the outskirts of Orlando, where our gym is at, but yeah, that is, and it's beyond the scope of this. But I'm not legally allowed to ride dirt bikes anymore because of my divorce and stuff that goes with it. So that's why it's not a dirt bike. Otherwise,
I was just curious. Yeah. So anything two wheels, that's awesome. Yep. And then I forgot to ask this early on. I meant to ask it early, you know, because of your history, your history in athletics and sports and what you did.
Yeah.
What does a workout look like for you on a daily basis or a monthly basis or a week? You know, what are you training for? What is the goal? And what does that workout look like for you nowadays? Now that you're, how old did you say you were?
I'm 55.
So what does that look like? And it may have changed. I know you had a heart attack a while ago, but what does a general workout for you look like? And what are your goals with that?
Well, I would love to get a race on the calendar, and I don't want this to come across as arrogant, but because we travel so much, I can never be in town long enough to get the training done and then actually do the race. Mm-hmm. So like right now we're working on camps for 2025. So we're looking at Poland, Germany, France, mm-hmm. England, UK. But I love to stay in, I love the challenge of staying in shape. So my schedule is pretty much the same every week. I try to Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I lift and I ride my bike. I only ride indoors because I live in Florida and it's horrible traffic. And then Tuesday is my off day because unfortunately, because of the way my call schedule is, mm-hmm. I'm on the phone from early morning to late in the evening. So then on the Thursday, the Saturday is my run in my swim days. And then Sunday is kind of like a hodgepodge. Usually we'll do 90 minutes of something. Usually it's our longer run day or our longer bike day.
So you kind of stay within the tri type of focus or mentality. You like that type of physical workouts and that focus.
Exactly. Swim, bike, run with weightlifting. I try to do each of them twice three times a week if I can. I try to dedicate at least 2 hours a day to training, and okay. I always do it first thing in the morning, so that way nothing gets in the way of it.
Uh-huh.
And I will be transparent to everybody. I use that time to solve the world's problems. I've created so many new digital products. I'll have epiphanies in the pool, and I'll actually get out of the pool. And I keep a spiral notebook with me wherever I go. So I've literally gotten out of the pool. Whenever I'm on my stationary bike, it's always sitting next to me. On the run's a little bit different because I don't take my phone with me. But yeah, it's therapeutic. It's a good release, but it also gives me a chance with no phone, email, text messages to actually just focus on like, what is it that the sport needs? Like I say this all the time. I put a video out every day on YouTube. And the reason why I do that is people email us questions. I convert them into a video. Cause if you have a question, it's always maybe a good
somebody
one.
Somebody else has a question.
Somebody else does as well. So what I'm always trying to pay attention to is, and this sounds a little fluffy, but like what's the needs, wants, and desires of our sport, the genesis behind this podcast show.
Right.
You know, you brought it up. I thought it was a great idea. And then we brainstormed on it a little bit more and we're like, yeah, you know what? The more we talk about it, the more we see that there's more information that most parents don't have.
Right.
You and I don't have big egos. We like to listen and we like to see a need, fill a need. Back to the Robin Williams again, quote from Robots. So yeah, for me, I love being fit. What I say about the triathlon side of the world is nothing is going to keep you more well-rounded and fitter than being a triathlete.
Because, I mean, yeah, it's funny you say that is because way back in the day, and I say way back for me, this is when I was born, but the Stanton era, the Bailey era, the Ward era, from what I recall, those guys were into Ironman triathletes, not just triathlons, but into the full-blown off-season type thing or whatever. I don't know when they could do it, but that just tells you how fit they even were back then. Mm-hmm. I actually think the 90s, obviously McGrath kind of, he wasn't not fit, let's be clear, but they went through a little bit of a different era. And then of course it came back. But I mean, that was that question I had about multi-sport athletes when your kid is younger is just maybe, you know, don't just put a focus on riding because you may overlook the discipline, the challenge, the, like you said, being around other elite athletes. And if you're competitive and if you're competitive by nature, and if you ride motocross, you probably are, then odds are you go to those sports, you don't want to be last. You don't want to lose. You don't want to be, you know, you want to compete. And by doing so, you'll get better at every avenue of that. You'll get better at swimming or get better at running or better at mountain biking or better at road biking. Exactly. So I think all of those things are great. Well, Rob, those are the questions I had for you. Is there anything you wanted to say before we tidied this up?
No, first and foremost, good job. Questions were great. Obviously we didn't rehearse them as we've said a couple times here today. And if you're somebody who has stuck with us and have watched the whole show or listened, thank you so much. If you've taken it in bite-sized morsels, thank you for doing that as well. But just remember, this is a podcast for you guys. So please feel comfortable to leave messages below. Like Derek said, we don't mind having adult conversations and we understand people are going to disagree. Just as long as you keep it, you know, amicable, we're definitely, I'm not saying anybody's going to disagree with us. Anything that we said wasn't designed to be bipolar, you know, polarizing. But most importantly, leave us questions. We've got a year's worth of guests and things that we want to talk about. But what we see in the sport manifesting itself is what's going to drive our conversation. So please engage with us. If you don't follow Derek on Instagram, please do. He's funny as all get out. Lots of cool stuff on there. And Derek, I just want to say thanks for another show, man. It's been 2 hours and it feels like literally it's been 15 minutes. I really enjoy this time.
We blew through the time today, but I really want to thank you for answering the questions. And it's crazy when you ask a simple question, we could have shows on probably each topic. So the depth of it's unbelievable to me. So I just, thanks for answering the questions. And hopefully here in the next couple little lineups, we're going to keep this rolling one way or another. So leave, like you said, questions, but hopefully we get to start bringing on some different types of guests. Like you mentioned Blair, that'd be cool if we can make that happen because he is who you need to appeal to as an amateur. Yep. And then there's other guys like that, but also other lineups that we've talked about. I think the guys are going to be excited about it.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, guys. And we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thanks so much.